I mean, what's Pro Football Focus doing? Last week they had Brady. This week they got Brady.
We're doing it. We're literally doing it differently from everybody else.
As a matter of fact, moving forward from this point on, I will not make reference to PFL.
Do you not understand that they are that way because you're Joe Flacco?
You just like to discredit things that people deserve credit for.
That you can't possibly be expected to defend that.
Talk about the game, Sam.
So,
who cares about what people think about us?
Yeah, I like football. I like football season, all the things that go with it.
Welcome in to the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Palazzolo here with Sam Monson. We're back together in the studio, man.
Yeah, long time between me being away, vacation, you being in Boston. It's been a lot of remote.
It's been a lot, but here we are. We're back in Cincinnati. Training camp is upon us. The buzz is real, man. I'm already seeing it. We got people going to the Hall of Fame after the first couple training camp practices.
Okay.
Yeah, it's happening.
And injuries started, which is the downside to training camp.
Yeah, as we speak, we've got Bucs center Ryan Jensen going to the locker room.
And, of course, Joe Burrow with having his appendix out.
Joe Burrow losing the appendix. Yeah, he's going to miss some reps.
Who needs it?
Who needs it? I mean, it's going to make it less exciting over at Bengals camp over there, you know, as far as seeing the reps. But, look, training camp has started. We're going to have a fun episode today. We're answering one question per team. We asked you guys to all be a part of that, to email us, to tweet at us. We almost have every team covered. We'll have every team covered by the time we get there, though.
Yeah.
Do we still need something for the Texans and the Raiders, potentially?
Yes. So if the YouTube
drop those
chat,
in the chat. Yeah.
The YouTube chat wants to help with that with those last couple. The other thing we got to do, this really highlights the problem with not requesting, you know, phonetic spelling of a name. If you're going to email us in and your name is not like Dan Jones, Bob Smith, you know,
give us some help.
Yeah. And look, some of them I think are reasonable, self-explanatory. Some of them are going to be a ride, you know. We're probably going to get them wrong.
Are you going to handle those today,
or should I give them a swing? But
should I do
we'll
all
see.
Of them? So we're going to go team by team. Before we get into it, though, a couple things we have to remind people. We put a survey out there, because we do love hearing from our listeners and our viewers. The survey's over at our Twitter account, at PFFNFLpod. That is the pinned tweet there. And we've used this survey in the past to change our show, right? To dictate, do we want to have three-hour shows, one-hour shows? Do we want to have more guests, fewer guests? So there's a lot of good questions on there, and love to get everybody's feedback.
Yeah, just a couple of minutes of your time, quick Google survey, and it'll help us with the direction of where we want to take the show and how to make it better.
So we'd appreciate anybody that could go and fill that out, like Sam said, just a couple minutes. And you want to talk about Charity Drive 7.0?
Yeah, finally started this one. This is, can I pitch a baseball 60 miles an hour? We're not going to spend 10 minutes talking about it on this show, but the GoFundMe is up. We are donating this time to a group called NEADS, NEADS, which is, do you have any idea how expensive like service dogs are? For, you know, people that need service dogs.
I don't.
It's a lot of money.
Really?
A lot of money. I have it written down in the thing here somewhere. Let me see. National Service Animal Registry estimates that a service dog costs a minimum of $17,000.
Really?
The total cost of training the dog is typically upwards of $40,000. So, you know, there's a lot of people that need service dogs. They don't have that kind of money lying around.
No, that's crazy.
In fact, most people don't have that kind of money lying around in any capacity. So NEADS picks up the slack, essentially, pays for all that kind of stuff and helps get service dogs to people that need them in a way that doesn't bankrupt them. So that's who we're donating to. And the whole thing is centered around whether I can pitch a baseball 60 miles an hour.
What's our goal here, Sam?
The goal on the GoFundMe is $2,500.
All right, so $2,500. Again, we've gotten great response from all of our listeners and viewers here. We appreciate everybody who's been a part of our previous charity drives. And this will be a fun one. Do we get to see 60 miles an hour?
And look, you can,
from Sam,
you can put comments in when you donate in the GoFundMe. So fire a comment, what you think the miles per hour is going to be. You know,
yes.
Give me the number you think we're going to hit, all those kinds of things. Let's get a bit of interaction going, because God knows people had opinions about this.
I've got strong opinions as well. Mm. I believe you're going to be under 60 miles an hour.
And we'll have to have our own, you know, side bet as to how much we'll put into this thing based off the over-under of 60.
So that's Sam's pinned tweet, at PFF underscore Sam.
Yep.
All right, you ready to get into it?
Mm-hmm.
We asked you, the viewers, the listeners, for a question for your particular team. So we're going to go through it. Let's start with, as always, the AFC East. That's how we do it. It's how you put it into this document here, Sam. The Buffalo Bills. The question from Michael Green. Nailed it. Bills were one of the most pass-happy teams in the NFL on early downs. Should they use that to run more in 2022?
You know what the funny thing is? You didn't nail it. You screwed it up. Oh. Read that again.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Right?
Michael Green.
Yeah, there's no R in there.
That's not a typo?
No, that's his name.
Didn't nail it.
No.
Gein.
You went for the layup and you missed.
Gein? It's G-E-E-N.
Yeah. Well done. 0-for-1.
I've missed dunks before. It happens.
Which seems tricky at your size.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you can't get up off.
Sorry, what was the question?
Should the Bills run more in early downs pass-happy team last year?
Yeah, the Bills have been one of the most aggressive passing teams in sort of neutral situations, all those kinds of things. I do think that there's a chance that they pivot a little bit and go more, a little bit more run heavy, not just to take advantage of the kind of looks that they're being given now. Not that it's, you know, necessarily more efficient, but it's always that balance, right? Of where does the reaction to the defense to what you're doing start to open up the thing that you're not doing, you know? And at what point are you better off taking that, even if generally it would be less efficient? Like, the whole thing is a cat and mouse game where at some point you have to bounce back and give them something else. So I think Buffalo established last year that they're going to be a very pass happy team. I would imagine that continues, but there are going to be situations now where they probably should zig where they would have zagged last year. And this is one of the reasons why I'm kind of, you know, optimistic about what we can see from James Cook. He's been brought in as this addition to the passing game, this run after the catch kind of guy. But I also think he might end up being their best running back and get some opportunities on these kind of passing type downs.
Astute answer, Sam. But I'll say no, they should not run the ball more on early downs.
Fair enough.
The answer that you gave, part of it was, you know, whatever the defense gives you. That's always my answer. I mean, that is football. That is a big part of football analytics, even, right? Box count and run when they want you to pass and pass when they want you to run. That's why early down passing has been the thing that the analytics movement has pushed. I'll just cite this really quickly here. Studies have shown that the linebackers, some of Eric Eager's work and everything, linebackers are biting less often on play action than they were, say, 2 years ago. Less movement. So the NFL is inviting the run a little bit more often. If that trend continues, maybe you run a little bit more on early downs. But I still think, as a whole, that strategy is fine for the Bills. Overall, I'd like to see them take a little bit of pressure off of Josh Allen. You know, so using Cook, as you mentioned, and using some of their other backs a little bit more, so it's not just the Josh Allen show every time you need a big play. I don't think that's a bad idea, but overall, I think you stick with the basic strategy of let's pass on early downs for sure.
We can't get too sidetracked during this show because
we got to stay on point, right?
Teams. But you know that Mike Sando article that comes out every year, the quarterback tiers thing?
Yes.
It's like your dream article. Tier quarterbacks.
Love good
and
tiers.
I don't even have to rank them.
Yeah.
Somebody, the funny thing about that article is you go down a rabbit hole with all the anonymous quotes and wanting to like shout at all the people that gave them, right?
So good work, Sando.
It was the Lamar Jackson thing. Then there was a guy basically saying that Patrick Mahomes isn't special if you make him go off his first read. I was kind of looking up some of these things to see how true or otherwise they are. Mahomes is like fourth or fifth in the NFL or something the last couple of years beyond his first read. You know who's number one by a reasonable margin?
Since we're talking about the Bills, I'm going to guess it's Josh Allen.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Josh Allen, number one, passes first read by pretty big distance, actually.
There was stuff like, oh, Joe Burrow predetermines his quick game too much, which is like what you
it's like
do.
Like the whole purpose of
right.
quick game.
That's what you do with quick game. I don't know.
It's like, it isn't quick if you have to read post snap. Like,
so now we know what Sando's doing at the combine when he's everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Everywhere you turn, Mike Sando's there. He's getting idiot quotes from idiot anonymous people. I say that in a loving way. You're not idiots. I love you guys, anonymous
some
scouts.
Idiots. Not, some of them are.
How many of those anonymous quoters are actually listening to us, I wonder?
I always think think, like, again, this is rabbit hole stuff, but I always think it's funny, like, when you're the guy that gives, like, the real idiot quote, right? And then it goes viral and it's everywhere. Like, when you see that on TV, are you, like, indignant? You're like, I was right. I stand by it, but I can't tell anyone because I look like an idiot.
That was me.
Or are you like, yeah, that was pretty dumb. Like,
they stand by it. I think they stand by it. Let's go Miami Dolphins. Where does Miami's O-line need to rank for Tua and the offense as a whole to be an above-average unit? James Villani sends in that question. Where do you think the O-line needs to rank for them to be above average?
If it ranks 20th, I think
that's
they can.
It, huh?
Yeah. I mean, so above average. I'm talking like, you know, sneak above average. If the offensive line ranks 20th, I think the platform is there for everybody else to do their job. Now, it doesn't mean it will. Like, if the offensive line ranks 20th and it turns out Tua stinks, it's not going to rank above average because Tua stinks. But if the offensive line ranks 20th, the platform is there for everybody else to be what they need to be, right? Now, then it just becomes whether they can do that or not.
So last year, using EPA per play, again, that would be the number that we would use to rank offenses as far as efficiency goes. Overall EPA per play during the regular season, the Dolphins ranked 23rd. So if they're 23rd in EPA per play, we're talking about them being above average as a unit. So we're talking being above 15th, 16th, 15th, essentially. Yeah. 15th or better. Yeah, I mean, jumping the offensive line up that high when they did this last year with the worst pass blocking grade in the NFL, if that jumps up just 8 or 10 spots, I think that's fair. So 20th, if they get up to 15th, though, 15th, 12th, if they get up into creep back toward average range or mm-hmm. average range, now we're talking maybe a really good offense here.
But again, it's all down to what Tua does, really. I mean, that just the offensive line is the foundation piece. Like, the offensive line the last couple of years has simply not been viable. It's like building your house on sand. It's just going to collapse as soon as the rain starts. But once the offensive line is somewhere in that below average to above average range, now you actually have some kind of, you know, concrete slab to build the rest on. But then it's like, what does Tua do?
I love the offseason. The more I think about it, the more I can see Tua just running the offense like Jimmy Garoppolo and putting up some big numbers and Mike McDaniel getting the most out of him. I think it's going
to
happen.
Well, he is the most accurate quarterback in the NFL, according to Tyreek Hill.
Tyreek said that?
Repeatedly. Yeah, that's his thing, apparently. Is, I mean, obviously.
Focus on his accuracy.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, clearly I can't directly compare Tua to Patrick Mahomes. So if I just call him the most accurate quarterback in the NFL every time I open my mouth.
New England Patriots, we have a scorching take from Joseph DeLeo. Has Bill Belichick shown the ability to adjust to the modern game as head coach and GM, and can they get back to the top with him in a post-Brady world? So the scorching take is a question, but it's essentially
leading
questioning
question. Yeah.
Whether or not Bill Belichick has been able to adjust to the modern game.
And honestly, it's not an unreasonable question to be asking at this point. Like, obviously, he's not bad, right? Whatever way you slice it. I mean, he's got Mac Jones. They're back to being a pretty good team. Like, Bill Belichick knows how to coach in the NFL, regardless of era. Period, right? I don't think there's any debate there. But the debate is now, and has been since they departed, like, which one? Brady or Belichick? Which is the genius? Which is the... Who's responsible for all the success? And obviously the answer is it's both and all of them put together. But Brady's got back to the mountaintop without Belichick. Can Belichick get back to it without Brady? That, I think, is an open question that is still reasonable to ask. And particularly while Belichick does build that team in a slightly different way than other people so far, right? He has an unusual approach to drafting certain positions. He apparently stinks at drafting wide receivers, period. And they're kind of building a lot of parts of this team to be focused on the run or sort of areas that aren't necessarily where you would pump the resources in today's NFL. So I think he can adjust to the modern game. I think he does do it in a slightly different way. And I think, I mean, it's the simple and easy and obvious answer, but what determines whether they're going to get back to the top is how good can Mac Jones get?
That's the question, man. There's already a lot of buzz. You're already getting the Mac Jones is so far ahead of, you know, this year as he was last year. The offense is new and simpler. And Belichick is taking to the offense a lot more. It's a tricky question, Sam. You know that, right? I mean, we have talked about if you're starting a franchise, you're going to start with the elite quarterbacks before the head coach, because I think there's enough evidence that say you have Mahomes, you have Aaron Rodgers, you have Tom Brady, you have Drew Brees, whoever it is, those guys are the biggest driver of success. Now, you can go, even if Bill Belichick or any head coach wins on the margins in free agency and in the draft and in player development and all the other places where you can win on the margins, it's really the margins. Because if you have Patrick Mahomes versus Sam Darnold at quarterback, that's going to make the difference in your team, not the margins that you're winning. So I think Belichick still has a history of doing that well. Overall, knowing how to draft. Overall, knowing how to develop defensive backs. Overall, knowing how to get the best out of his players and all that stuff. But I don't think we're going to have a clear answer to this question, which is, like you said, unless Mac Jones is a legitimate top 10 quarterback. Unless he goes from, and you see a lot of the write-ups and then Sando's thing and even some of our takes, it's like, is he better? Can he be better than a Derek Carr? Can he be better than a Kirk Cousins? Can he be a carry the team type of guy? Because the carry the team type of guy, you think skill set, you think Josh Allen, you think Justin Herbert, but like you don't think that with Brady skill set wise, but he carries the team. So if Mac Jones can take that step forward, then that's the answer, right? Belichick has found the next guy, he's developed the next guy, and he can be a Super Bowl contender once again without Tom Brady. But I still think Belichick's a very good head coach, does a lot of good things. Could he do better on, say, fourth down decisions and some other things? Sure. But I wouldn't necessarily say he has not adjusted to the modern game, and I don't think you get a clear answer to this because it's so dependent on the quarterback.
Here's another point. Can you get back to the top with Matt Patricia calling plays?
On offense. Is he really calling plays? We don't even have titles
yet. He is. Yeah.
Oh, I thought Belichick was calling plays. I was envisioning a world where Belichick was just going to call plays for both sides of the ball. You know?
So one of the big parts of it is apparently, like, if they don't designate Patricia a coordinator, Detroit is still paying him. Like, it's like a money saving exercise.
Oh, that's what they're doing?
Yeah. So because
and you say Belichick hasn't adjusted to the modern game. This is chess, man.
Once the guy gets a job as a coordinator, like, that team's picking up the bill. But as long as he's, I think it's whatever the rule is, like, as long as he's a lower position than the one he left or got fired from or whatever, or just lower than coordinator level, the previous team is like still picking up the tab for a salary.
This basically comes down to, like, what should you expect from a coach when they have X at quarterback? You know, what should you expect from Andy Reid when he has Patrick Mahomes at quarterback? What should you expect from Matt Rhule when he has Sam Darnold or Baker Mayfield in that roster? That's the key thing. And I don't know that you can have massive expectations for the Patriots other than maybe what they did last year. You win 10 games, you get into the playoffs. If they do make that that unexpected playoff run like they did with Brady early in his career, though, then you say, okay, Belichick still has it. New York Jets. Every time lately the Jets have been 500 or better, it's been the D carrying the load. Defense. Will that happen this year? And if so, how good would that defense need to be?
It's interesting, actually, when you look at the head coaches the Jets have had. Like, they've had a lot of defensive head coaches. Okay, Adam Gase, you know. Well, whatever. But
was he either offense or defense?
Rex Ryan, Todd Bowles, Robert Saleh now. In a league that's pivoting ever more offense, the Jets have been plowing that defensive furrow for a while. I think if the Jets are 500 or better this year, it's because Zach Wilson took a giant leap forward and that offense is pretty good. Given how far away the defense was a year ago, I can't really see a world where they drag the offense to 500 or better, or even that they're the better unit on this team necessarily.
All right, I have a take on this.
Okay,
I think as a domes matter type of guy, right? Environment matters. I think historically we look at teams in part because of their environment, right? So you think back to the Bears, and it's like, well, the Bears always have great defenses. And even if you look at the AFC East, the Patriots historically generally have good defenses, or this question that the Jets have had a good defense when they've been good. I think where you play helps your defense or hurts your defense, right? So these outdoor teams, bad weather teams, it's not that the whole season's played in bad weather, but you always have swirling winds in New York, which is why historically it's tough to play offense there, right? That stuff does matter, right? We've all played, like, even just like a pickup football game in the rain versus in really good weather. It does change, and the stats show that in the NFL that things change. So sometimes I think we get caught up in, like, well, the Jets are only good because their defense is good, when I think sometimes you might look at it the other way and say the environment allowed their defense to be a little bit better and hurt their offense a little bit more. So I don't necessarily think that this – so what I'm – the point is, I think you would get into trouble if you saw this pattern and you're like, oh, the Chicago Bears, the only way you can win Chicago is with a defensive-minded head coach and do defensive stuff, when it's more like Chicago allows you to have a better defense. This will be tested once they have their cool little dome in a few years, and all of a sudden maybe they could become – an offensive team. So I would not look at historical trends and say, well, the Patriots win with defense and the Bills win with defense and the Jets win with defense, or whatever these cold weather cities are. The Steelers win. Steelers always have a good defense. Yeah, it's tough to play offense in Pittsburgh in November in defense, December. So I think the environment affects that a little bit, and I don't think that the Jets need to focus on their defense. That said, I mean, they need, like, to be 500 or better, I think their defense needs to be probably top 15. They need to be much better than they were last year. They were atrocious in certain spots last year. Remember, 200 yards, was it 300 yards of, 300 passing yards, 200 rushing yards against the Colts. I mean, just
yeah, they train were, wreck. They were the team that allowed the
Urban Meyer's goals, right. Weekly goals.
Yeah, yeah. The ones that seemed absurd because they are.
250, it, 250, I think it was.
It happened against the Jets, I think.
Yeah. Does that answer the question?
Yeah,
top 15 defense to get to 500.
Did you, we read out that guy's name, did we?
Sam Kodama.
Yeah.
Thank you for your question on the New York Jets. Let's go to the Baltimore Ravens. Is it realistic to think if Rashad Bateman takes a jump, the Ravens wide receiver core is no worse than last year, even minus Marquise Brown? That's from J.P. Vayer.
Yeah.
Thank you for the pronunciation there.
Yeah. Not spelled Vayer. Anything like that, but pronounced that way, apparently.
I would have said Valu.
Well, it's a good thing we wrote it out then.
Yes.
Realistic? Maybe. I think it's definitely possible. I don't think Bateman was great as a rookie, but obviously injury slowed him down and kind of led to a late start and all those kinds of things. But I think he showed enough to say he can be a better number one for this offense than Marquise Brown was, you know, who didn't necessarily tick all the boxes, provided a good deep threat, provided a good big play aspect to the offense off the back of play action, all those kinds of things. But Bateman has a much more complete skill set. And if you therefore say, all right, he gets better year two, takes a jump, he provides a much more sensible number one option. And then what does number two and three look like relative to Bateman and everybody else last year? And in particular, knowing that Mark Andrews is essentially the number one receiver in that offense, I think it's definitely possible, and it's certainly close enough that when you factor in the contract for Marquise Brown and the first round pick you got for him, I'd say it's a win.
Yeah, so that's the angle there, right? If the question is, will the wide receiver core be better, even with the huge step forward from Bateman, I don't know that they're going to be better. I think there was a point last year.
Yeah, but the question is, will it be worse? Because everybody's assuming, like, this is one of the worst wide receiver rooms in the NFL. They got rid of the only good player. I do think it's a fair question that actually that might be closer than people think it is when you factor in the jump, the potential jump from Bateman.
Yeah, if Bateman takes a jump, it might not be worse. And again, I think there was a point last season when Lamar was playing well, before his drop-off, before his injury, where it looked like the best wide receiver core that they'd had with Lamar Jackson. And they were playing as such with Marquise Brown. Bateman was coming back. They had Sammy. They looked much better. They actually had multiple weapons. And then Mark Andrews did take this massive step forward into that, I would say, top tier, right? This QB-proof tight end that Mark Andrews became last year. So that's the tricky part. I think their peak last year was the best that we've seen from Lamar Jackson. They weren't as consistent, and they had injuries, and they had issues. So if Bateman takes a big step forward, sure, they'll be as good as last year. Because Andrews took that huge step forward as well.
Okay, done.
All right.
That was an easy one.
Thank you, JP. Cincinnati Bengals. Can Cincinnati feasibly pay Joe Burrow, T. Higgins, and Ja'Marr Chase big money extensions, or will one have to depart? That's from Jason Teitelbaum.
I think they could do it. I don't think they will.
Yeah, I think the proxy for this is probably the Chargers paying Keenan Allen and Mike Williams, both over $20 million, but both right around 20, right? They're not, you don't have a $30 million receiver.
They also don't have, they're able to do that because Justin Herbert is still on the rookie
deal. And Herbert's still on the rookie deal.
These are all,
there'll
be
a point where there's a crossover there and they'll have to make a decision.
Yeah.
To me, it's Higgins is obviously the guy that would be the odd man out.
Right.
And you're looking at, okay, is he worth, say, $20 million? He's probably, Mike Williams is probably a good proxy for him, especially if Higgins develops a little bit. You know, they're similar type of receivers, big-bodied, number 1A, 1B, two, you know, number 2 types. Higgins is probably the odd man out because we're talking Chase probably getting $30 million, and Burrow's going to, whoever signs first, Burrow or Herbert's going to, you know, set the record, essentially, for highest paid QB. So I'll say no. Which means, you know, once again, I always use the phrase, like, I never want to see Patrick Mahomes without Tyreek Hill. As the Bengals, I think you never want to see Joe Burrow without an excellent receiving core. Because the year that he had, fresh Ja'Marr Chase, second year T. Higgins, Tyler Boyd pushed to the number 3, that's when you get highest graded Joe Burrow. That's when you get Super Bowl run. I think that's always the pattern that you want to have, right, offensively. So I think you lose Higgins, and you have to throw a lot of resources draft-wise for cheap wide receivers that could potentially replace him in the coming years.
Yeah, I suspect that's why. I mean, I'm not sure whether they had this in mind all along in terms of not wanting to pay Jesse Bates because of how volatile safety play is and all those kinds of things. But now, after the season those guys just had, I suspect it's being complicated even more with the idea of, like, do you really want to have resources tied up in Jesse Bates in a couple of years' time when you have to pay all these offensive superstars that are playing at a much more important positions relative to, you know, wins and losses and that kind of thing? So I think they're already planning on the kind of contracts you're going to have to give out. And as much as I think you could tie down all three to a big money deal, I just don't, it just doesn't feel like a Bengals type of move to spend that amount of money on three players. I would imagine they're figuring out how much money needs to go to Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase to the exclusion of everything else on the roster.
Yeah, and I think that's the smart move. It is interesting, man. They've played the positional value game. You know, if they're going to – it's tempting to pay Jesse Bates. He's a good player. He made huge plays in the playoffs. But I think you're right. Having that 3- and 4-year outlook of having Jesse Bates on the roster versus what you have to pay for Chase and Burrow is smart. And even just taking Ja'Marr Chase over Penei Sewell, I honestly don't believe that move happens five years ago, 10 years ago in that NFL. You feel you get your left tackle, you get the, you know, right tackle for Sewell. I think the Bengals are playing the positional value game by holding off on Bates and being ready for Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase. T. Higgins will be the odd man out, would be my answer.
Yeah.
Cleveland Browns, how much did Cleveland give up for Jimmy G if Deshaun Watson gets suspended for the whole year?
Yeah, this is tricky.
They're all tricky. They're good questions.
I keep getting asked about this every time I do a radio hit, the Browns and what they do with quarterback and the suspension and Jimmy G and all this kind of stuff. And they're in this tough spot because the talk on the suspension is anything from a full year, which I think would make them, if it's a full year, they have to decide, do we just sacrifice this season, right? Stick where we are. Give the year to Jacoby Brissett and essentially say we're not contending this year? Or do you make a move for effectively Jimmy G as the only possible viable quarterback out there available to start the whole season on a 1-year bridge type deal, get rid of him next year and hand back over to Watson? If it's less than that, and Florio at one point was saying 6 to 8 games or something as a period, if it's 6 to 8 games, now you have a different calculation because now you're looking at Jacoby Brissett and saying, okay, I mean, he's the kind of guy that can win you a couple of games here or there.
In that 6 to 8 game window.
Yeah, so if it's 6 to 8, and in particular, if you look at Cleveland's schedule, it's a lot easier in the first half of the year than it is the second half of the year. So if it's the first 6 to 8 games, like, they might be looking at that and saying, we can get out of that with Brissett at quarterback at 500. And if we're 500 with half the season left to go and Watson coming in, we're still in contention, right? That, I think, is a tough decision for them to make. So if the suspension is a year and But then, so if the suspension is a year, I think you probably do want to make a move, and Jimmy G is the guy. But now you're back to this. You know, we think that the 49ers are probably going to cut him. But if they cut him, he could go somewhere else. So do you flip them something just to guarantee it? Or do you run the risk that you can pick him up ahead of, you know, Seattle or whatever?
According to Over the Cap, the Browns have $48 million in cap space.
Yeah.
So
they have the money to do it.
They could pay to have Garoppolo. I agree with you. If it's 6 to 8, no. If it's a full season, sure. Like, take a shot with Garoppolo. And I'm interested in that. I want some Jimmy G data points, man.
But if you're trading for him, you are a market of one.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably flipping a fourth rounder for him, which is, you know.
A fourth?
Yeah. That's it.
It's not even that high.
Not even that high?
You're giving him like a conditional sixth just to be front of the queue.
Yeah.
Like the conditional sixth conditioned on him actually lasting the season.
What does Garoppolo sign for? Does he sign for anything next offseason? Is there any compensatory pick consideration here?
Because if you get him. It depends how he plays, right?
Yeah. I mean, if he does have a really good season and, you know, the Giants are looking at him or whatever it might be next year, who knows? So that's the other thing to consider. You could flip a late rounder, pay him for the year, maybe get a third back if someone else pays him next year. So
a late day three pick.
Day three pick. Yeah, and I'd do it if it's full year suspension for Watson.
Yeah.
That was the question anyway. All right, Pittsburgh Steelers. Why is Pittsburgh's cornerback room so bad? Can they develop and not be a disaster this year?
Good question.
I don't think they're that bad. I think they're
very not good, though.
Well, it's Akella Witherspoon and Levi Wallace are two guys who are solid. They're guys who I think have enough of a track record that GM Steve would want them on my team, but not as the top two corners.
Yeah, which they are.
I get it. So I think they're good moves. They re-signed both guys. They re-signed Witherspoon and they signed Levi Wallace. I think those in isolation are good moves. But if they had like Joe Hayden from 5 or 6 years ago, it makes it a better move. But they don't have that right now. They don't have another guy that's ahead of them. So here's the other thing I'll say, and we do mention this a little bit. I talk about this a little bit, right? Some defenses emphasize corners more than others, right? If you play more man, you rely on your corners more. The Steelers historically have relied on their middle of field players a little bit more than their corners, so they can get away maybe with subpar corners. On the other hand, when they had a really good defense a couple years ago, it was when they had Steven Nelson and Joe Hayden and Cameron Sutton, all three guys playing pretty well. I'm sorry, Mike Hilton, Cam Sutton was filling in. Like, they were 3 and 4 deep at corner, and that is certainly much better for your defense than maybe what they have right now.
Yeah, I as much as I love Levi Wallace, I have a concern that in Pittsburgh he will have a much more difficult job than he had in Buffalo, and consequently might perform significantly worse. So that could be an area of concern. The other thing is, like, you can have a cornerback room that isn't great when you lead the league in pressure rate, which the Steelers did a couple of years ago.
Right.
When you don't, and when you're actually miles away from it, and it's basically just TJ Watt getting a ton of pressure and sacks, and really sacks more than pressures, it makes that cornerback group look a lot worse. They get exposed more. So if the Steelers front seven is able to bounce back and, you know, get a lot more pressure than they did last year, the cornerback room looks a lot better. Now, maybe you can argue, hey, they should probably be aware of that, right? And sort of understand that things have changed and that they're not going to lead the league in pressure again. And if they don't, you might want to invest some more in that cornerback group.
Yeah, so that's it. You know, I think it's where they like to put their resources defensively. It's the fact that they do rely on pressure. They do rely on five-man rushes a little bit more than most teams. Maybe don't play as much man. They've fluctuated in recent years. Like last year, they were 19th in just straight up cover one percentage. You know, that's your most common man coverage. So you don't rely on your corners as much. So I think maybe Steelers can get away with that a little bit more. So AFC North. We're through 8 teams. Are we going too slow?
No, we're about right.
We're about on pace. This is pretty good.
We are missing team, though, in the AFC South is Houston. So we'll do them last and give the chat a chance to throw in some Texans questions.
Give me a Texans question, or I'll make one up with a fake name. I'll say Steph Stradley asks or something like that. The diehard Houston Texans fan. Indianapolis Colts. Better offensive line, better weapons, Will Matt Ryan rise from the ashes and be the clear, in all caps, best QB in the AFC South? Spencer Schreiner asks this question.
No.
Whoa. Who will be?
Well, in order for him to be the clear best quarterback, he would need to be significantly better this year than Ryan Tannehill. And I just think that's probably an unreasonable ask. Is he going to be like, why would he be dramatically better than Ryan Tannehill based off the evidence of the last couple of years for both players?
Tannehill's been better in a more protected scheme and all that stuff, but you know, Tannehill could.
He's still there.
He could still regress back into Miami Tannehill, which is a mid-70s type of quarterback, and then you get Matt Ryan.
I mean, he could, but why would
elevating he? Up to an 85 quarterback? I think that's a realistic possibility.
Is it?
Yeah.
Why?
Because in any given season, because at the end of the season, I was like, I go to you, Sam. Ryan Tannehill was a 75. Matt Ryan, you know, had a rejuvenated season and graded at 85. It's pretty clear. It's a clear difference. That's an egregious thing that we could be discussing in January? I don't think so.
I mean, so Matt Ryan, in two of the last 3 years, has a grade of basically 75. He's gone 75, 76, 83, 75. That I would imagine is his baseline at this point. So, as much as you gain from
Tannehill's going the other way, he's been.
It's a better offensive line. I don't know if the receiving group is that much better.
I agree. I think Colts fans might overrate their weapons a little bit. On the other hand, they scored a lot of points last year. The Colts offense scored a ton of points. Mm. Granted, 50 of them came against the Jets, but they scored a ton of points last year with a Carson Wentz, you know, playing conservative ball. And the running back carrying them, Jonathan Taylor.
I can imagine a world where Matt Ryan sort of hits his best season of the last three. So he's 83, 82 again. My bigger point is I'm just not sure why Ryan Tannehill would suddenly turn back into a pumpkin. He's since turning up in Tennessee, he's been 92.5, 90.3, 83.5, which is
the
ceiling, right? That the 83.5, the lowest point of Tannehill, is the highest point that Matt Ryan has hit in the last 3 years. And that was when Derrick Henry missed half the year. Derrick Henry is going to be back this season. You know, I was on David Chow's podcast, Pro Football Doc, and he's like talking up Derrick Henry because this is not... It's not the kind of injury that is a long-term concern. It's not a lingering thing. It's not a repeating thing. It's just like one thing that puts you down for half a year or a year. So Henry's going to be back this season, and when that happens, they've got Robert Woods, they've got Treylon Burks, they've got weapons, they've got, you know, the offensive line is a question mark. But again, why would Tannehill stink?
A.J. Brown. Losing A.J. Brown.
Right. You gain Robert Woods, you gain Treylon Burks and his asthma. I saw a catch the other day in training camp. Treylon Burks like plucks it out of the sky on a deep bomb. Looked just like A.J. Brown.
All right, I'm glad that you're in now. I'm glad you're into Dante Moncrief, you know, July superstars. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you're finally on board with buying into all the training camp hype. So if I was betting, you know, we'll have a betting show soon. We got like over 40 bets to make decisions on. We appreciate everybody. Maybe slow down a little bit, guys. We can't bet on everything. If I was betting, I'd say no. You know, Matt Ryan will not be the clear top quarterback in the AFC South. But it's not like 100%. You know, I'm more like 60-40 saying no. 70-30. So I'll say no.
I think that's a pretty resounding no for me.
Resounding no. I'll say a soft no. Matt Ryan will not be the best.
Clear best quarterback.
Clear best. We're talking, you know, 8 to 10 grading points better than Tannehill. Plus Trevor Lawrence, you know, in that mix, and Davis Mills in that mix.
Yeah. Did you read out that person's name, or am I just blanking those every time?
No, Spencer. Yeah. For the Jaguars, we have a question from someone called Everybody.
Yeah, look, pretty much everyone asks the same question for Jacksonville, which is like, just how big is the upgrade from Urban Meyer to Doug Peterson? And is everybody, you know, underselling how big an upgrade that is?
I think this is one you have to answer with off the field, from an off the field standpoint. So of our listeners, has anyone had just a really good boss and a really bad boss? Have you ever had that A-B analysis of working under a boss where productivity suffers and then one where productivity thrives? I think everybody can probably relate. I mean, I've never really worked a real job, played baseball, then showed up here at PFF, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But I'm sure other people can relate to having good and bad bosses and seeing the difference in productivity. Well, and I think that's like the starting point. We're not talking X's and O's. Like, we're talking horrible situation versus just a reasonable situation from Meyer to Peterson and how that's going to affect the entire squad.
Yeah, or you go back to, you know, school or college with teachers.
Yeah, that's a good
right?
one.
I mean, it's for a different reason, but imagine the difference between, like, the best teacher you had and the substitute teacher that came in and the class went nuts and the teacher just couldn't control anything, right? Now, that it's not a – the reasons are different, right? Urban Meyer didn't – it wasn't bad because he lost control of everybody. It was bad because of the opposite. Like, he had too much control, tried to treat everybody like children, was kicking his kicker, all those kinds of things, right? But I think the output is the same, which is one of them is a great experience and the other one is a terrible experience and nobody benefits from. So that, I think, is the difference, is you're going from what is – and every extra quote, every story, every new piece of information that comes out only enhances just how absurdly toxic that situation appears to have been with Urban Meyer and how incredibly – it blows my mind continually that guy has been as successful as he has with that attitude, even adjusting for the difference between, like, college and professional, you know, athletes and all those kinds of things, right?
And that's different from, say, Bobby Knight at Indiana having a history of, say, anger issues, but ultimately the players liked him, right? I mean, this is a different thing. Yeah. This is like nothing Urban Meyer did was positive for his team. And I think we might look back and remember when they upset the Bills. 9-6, they beat the Bills. Like, the Urban Meyer Jaguars.
Josh Allen game.
In what?
Josh Allen game.
The Josh Allen game, right? Josh when Allen Josh Allen of Josh the Jaguars, Allen. You know, established dominance mm-hmm. with his name
right.
over the other Josh Allen. We're going to look back at that game saying, what? How? Especially, like, if the Bills went on to
well,
win
that's
the
how.
Super Bowl.
I mean, it was the Josh Allen
It was
game.
Josh Allen of the Jaguars took over.
But, yeah, so I think that there is a
– I think it's three – it's like a three-game baseline. You're going to win three more games just by showing up.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, just by everybody not hating their existence, being in that building, it is going to be huge. And I think that's a fair thing. Every time – like, yeah, it is going to be a massive difference just everybody going to work and actually pulling in the same direction rather than everybody going to work and hating the job because the guy in charge is a lunatic.
Big difference then. All right, you read out the Titans question. I'll surf the chat, see if we have any Texans questions here.
If Derrick Henry is no longer King Henry, where does Tennessee slip to in the AFC? And that's Nick from Tennessee.
Well, Nick, I think that's another three games. I think that could be a tough one because, yeah, they won a lot without Henry last year. I get it, but he's the type of guy that we come on here because we analyze every single game during the season, and we look at a macro level. We look at I wouldn't pay running backs and all that stuff. But there's two or three times a year where like, hey, that was yesterday's game was Derrick Henry taking over, mm-hmm. or yesterday's game was Dalvin Cook taking over, right? Like, running backs can do that at times at an individual level, and it does feel like Derrick Henry does that two or three times a year. Where if you chase it too much, it's probably detrimental to the team. If you just try to give him 30 carries every game just because, it's probably detrimental over time. But there are certain games where it's just like, man, you couldn't tackle him in the fourth quarter and overtime or whatever it might be. I think you're talking about a couple game difference here for the Titans. I think A.J. Brown's the bigger issue. But if you then lose Derrick Henry and his ability, it's tough to replicate what the Titans did last year, which was beat all the good teams, do it with all these players that people have never heard of and still end up with the number one seed. It'll be tough to replicate that.
Yeah. I mean, I do think they slip a lot. Like, even last year, the half year without Derrick Henry, Ryan Tannehill took a step back. And okay, they still won games, but they weren't the same force. And remember, we are like a year removed from going into that year and questioning everything we know about running backs and their relationship with offense because of Derrick Henry, right? It's like, maybe Derrick Henry is actually the thing that causes Ryan Tannehill, not Ryan Tannehill causing Derrick Henry, right? Which is the question we would ask for everybody else. That's the kind of performance Derrick Henry has been giving over the last few years, and that's probably not changing just because he missed half the year with his first real injury in forever. So if he isn't that guy anymore, they go back to being, and particular this AFC, right, what everybody has just done this offseason, the arms race, et cetera, I don't know that they make the playoffs if Derrick Henry is just an ordinary running back.
Well, sorry, Nick. Nick from Tennessee.
I think at that point they lose out to Indianapolis, and whoever loses out in that division I don't think is getting a wild card this year. So they become just another team.
All right, I found the Texans question from Twitter.
Okay.
And it's about, you know, considering what the Texans will have in next year's draft, how many capable or quality starters would they need to find this season in order to compete for the playoffs or division in 2023? So in other words, what are the Texans fans, like, what are they looking for? Assuming they're not going to make the playoffs this year, what should the Texans fans be rooting for? How many players do they need to find this year who are going to be a part of the 2023 team and, you know, them making a playoff push?
I think it's the young guys. It's just sort of trying to find a couple of, you know, the thing about the Texans is they haven't really started this yet. You know?
By the way, but it's also just the quarterback, right? I mean, it would have to Davis Mills looks really good. Not just like, oh, pretty good for a third rounder. Really good in year two.
I'm working on the basis that the long-term starting quarterback of the Texans is not on the roster right
okay.
now. Right? I don't think that Davis Mills, as much as he outperformed expectations as a rookie, I don't think he's going to end up being the guy at the end of this year. And in particular, I don't know that he has the platform to be the guy this year. So if he did show it, it would be really impressive. But let's assume that the quarterback is not a realistic thing for them, at which point they haven't yet had a chance to invest the stockpile that they've accumulated from trading away Deshaun Watson, from treading water over the last couple of years. So the best they can hope is that a few of the players that they've just drafted through having to spend picks over the last couple of years actually turn into something. So guys like Nico Collins at wide receiver, he flashed a little bit as a rookie. If he takes a year or two jump and actually ends up being a really good wide receiver, a good starter, that's huge for them. They locked up Brandon Cooks, so that would all of a sudden give them a pretty good wide receiver group. Poor old John Metchie was diagnosed with leukemia and isn't going to show up, isn't going to, you know, be a factor in year one. Hopefully he recovers, hopefully he beats that and we get to see him in future. But he won't be a factor this year. But that I think is it, is essentially the young guys that they've invested in the last couple of years are long-term solutions. Guys like Jonathan Grenard, who had a really good pass rushing grade last year, had something like 27 pressures and like 200 pass rushes, which is a pretty good return. If he gets given a larger role and continues to rush the passer at that kind of level. So it's not a huge amount, I think, but if you can come away with, you know, three or four of those young guys that you've drafted the last couple of years looking like cornerstone pieces, that's big.
Yeah, so Grenard's a good example. You've got next year they do have a lot more players under contract, right? It's not a whole bunch of 1-year deals this year where guys are going to be gone next year. So Jalen Petre in the draft could be another guy you're looking at. So to me, it's like one guy per position group, right? Get another defensive lineman to develop, get a linebacker, get a couple guys in the secondary. You know, hopefully Stingley is as advertised. Mm-hmm. And then you upgrade a quarterback potentially, and maybe you're competing. So 6 or 7, you know, like a guy per position that you feel pretty good about moving forward if you're the Texans. So let's say six to eight players that you feel good about that are solid starters. And then you start building around that in the draft and free agency and whatever you do at quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, if you assume they already have a bunch of those players.
Right, that's saying like a Laremy Tunsil's right. already still pretty good, and yeah. Brandon Cooks is already still pretty good, and maybe
I think
you flip him for
if
more.
If they come out of this year with like 3 or 4 young guys that are new in terms of adding to that list, right? So
yeah.
Brandon Cooks, Laremy Tunsil, those are guys you know are there long-term and are good. If you can add 3 or 4 guys of, you know, like the Jonathan Grenards of the world, the Nico Collins of the world, if you can add 3 or 4 of those names, then I think they're in.
Yeah.
That was a good season.
Do we have something for the Broncos here? Are they missing as well?
No, it looks like they are missing.
Oh, you didn't highlight them.
I didn't, no.
We're going to skip the AFC West for a minute here.
Entirely.
We'll come back to the AFC West and get their questions. I mean, we can also make up our own questions. I mean, it's going to be Russell Wilson and the odd things. Things we've talked about before.
Definitely had Broncos questions, right?
You'll have to find out. Let me go to the NFC East here. Dallas Cowboys, where does Michael Gallup rank among number 2 wide receivers, and would you have paid him $50 million on a 5-year deal? From Bobby Nelson. I would say I didn't go back and rank all of the number twos. I apologize. But I would say he's top three or four number two wide receivers.
Mm-hmm.
That's and when you do when I think when you say that, it's like, well, the Bucs kind of have two number one wide receivers, so I'm not comparing Michael Gallup to, say, Chris Godwin, I don't think.
Okay.
But I think if you when I look at number two wide receivers, I'm looking at like a Corey Davis on that list. Maybe you put a Mike Williams on that list, right? And I think Gallup's right up there. And I think $10 million a year for a Gallup is good. I think that's fine. That's cheaper than a Corey Davis. And I think Gallup's probably a you know better rounded player that can win at more, you know, all levels versus Davis, who's a little bit more limited.
Yeah, when you consider that the Chargers are paying two different receivers $20 million a year to have one of the best number two wide receivers in the league locked up at $10 million a year at half that cost, I think is a steal. So wide receiver is one of the most important positions in the NFL. To dedicate $10 million a year for a second player at that spot, I think is absolutely fine. And yeah, I would do that deal with Gallup all day.
All right. So we like it. It's a good deal for the Cowboys. New York Giants, what's a Daniel Jones improvement you would expect to see brought on by Brian Daboll? That's from David O. Brings that question to us. What kind of improvement from Daniel Jones?
He was asking kind of specific things that Brian Daboll can improve about Daniel Jones. And one of the things I think that Daboll will do is simply bring an offense that gets you into the right play more often. You know, which sounds like a really obvious and simple thing, but the quarterback is going to look better when he's executing a play that is attacking the right area of your defense at the right time in the right situation, and he's not trying to do something that's simply not on based off what the defense is running. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And those are things that are difficult to quantify, but the play calling element, I think, is a much bigger thing for Daniel Jones year one than any hope that Daboll will come in and like rework his mechanics and all of a sudden he'll be like a better, more accurate, you know, you're not going to see like this Josh Allen-esque leap from Daniel Jones because of Daboll coming in and like fundamentally retooling his skill set. But you might see a significant jump from him simply by the play calling being better and Daboll actually running things that are scheming receivers more open than what we've seen in the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing that we talked about earlier today is how pass heavy the Bills have been. So just not working in an offense that's run pass, that doesn't have motion. I mean, there'll just be more freebies in there, right? It'll be early down passes when teams are playing the run a little bit more. There'll be a little bit more motion. There'll be more open throws. So I think production-wise, Daniel Jones can take a step forward. You'd expect better stats.
Right, and I think it'll show up almost across the board. I think you'll see a better accuracy rate from Jones. I think you'll see a higher, you know, yard per attempt figure. You'll see a better passer rating. Like, these are the ways that kind of improved play calling will manifest itself, and you'll probably see a better PFF grade because of it.
All right, there you go. So, Mr. Daniel Jones apologist over here, you're expecting Pro Bowl season from Daniel Jones? Pro Bowl.
No.
Oh, okay.
But I do expect him to be better.
All right, Philadelphia Eagles from Joe McCulley. Are the Eagles and everything they've done to build this roster, are they doomed if Jalen Hurts doesn't get any better?
No, they're not doomed, but it's not ideal. I think they've played the game well in terms of hedging with Jalen Hurts. They're not all in with Jalen Hurts, a quarterback, and if he doesn't work out, the whole thing is busted. You know, it's a busted flush. They need to blow it all up, start over. They've set themselves up in a pretty reasonable position to be able to pivot away from Jalen Hurts if he doesn't improve and isn't clearly the guy. And in particular, I think, when his contract is due, you know? So if they get to that Baker Mayfield decision period where it's like, okay, $40 million a year or not, yes or no, and they decide no, I think they can get away from Jalen Hurts and the roster is still in a good position and they still have capital to go after another quarterback. So it's definitely a setback, and they've built a team that I think could reasonably contend this year if Jalen Hurts takes a step forward and is the guy. But if he isn't, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, look, I think the pivot to the running game last year, as we say all the time here, raises the floor of the offense. Hurts doesn't necessarily have to develop. So doomed, again, is the wrong word. Like, the Eagles were a playoff team last year with Jalen Hurts, as is. The roster is probably better this year. So doomed, no. Are they make a Super Bowl run? Probably not, right? With this roster and some of the moves they've made, and maybe we've overrated some of the moves, but I love A.J. Brown. You know, Jordan Davis is going to be one of the more intriguing stories for football nerds, I think, and what that does for their defense and their early down run defense and all that fun stuff. But if Jalen Hurts is the same guy, they're still probably a borderline playoff team. If he gets better, maybe they're that, you know, don't want to play the Eagles, right? Remember, every week we change who the team is that you just don't want to run into in the playoffs. That's at least the Eagles, you know, if Hurts gets better.
I don't want to play good teams ever.
Oh, you don't want to play
like a bad team.
You don't want to play anybody in the playoffs.
Every time I would like to have the weakest opposition possible.
This is the Jaguars' strategy. They don't want to play teams in the playoffs.
And well, it's an easy way of
that's how you do it. Certain teams have goals, and then they hit them every year.
It's like that philosophy of you're going to have to beat the best teams at some point. It's not true. You can have a charmed existence and face the worst team possible all the way through.
Plus, you get more offseason.
Somebody else might knock out the best team, and you have to face them. You know, you don't have to face the best team every time.
That's a good point. Also a good point. All right, Washington Commanders. Speaking of the playoffs, we have from at Eat Sleep Hail. It seems that the goal for the Washington Commanders this season is to make the playoffs. What does the team need to do to make that happen?
They need to make sure that Carson Wentz is very happy. You know, he doesn't get bummed out. He doesn't start looking over his shoulder and think, ooh, that Sam Howell guy's got a big arm and a fine beard, and I should be concerned about that. He needs to just be happy and, you know, live his best life and just air the ball out to Terry McLaurin and hope everything goes well. Like, they genuinely need Carson Wentz to get back to at least 2019 Carson Wentz. Is essentially the bottom line. And the best way of that happening is for Carson Wentz to be happy with his existence.
So remind people, 2019, Carson Wentz's career in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Decent for a rookie in 2016, MVP caliber, you know, high-end quarterback in 2017. Pretty much average in 18 and 19, and the situation got worse, so the stats got worse. 2020, worst starting quarterback in the NFL. 2021, the lower end of average, we'll say, for Wentz. QB 20.
Much worse than his 27 touchdowns, the 7 interception box score would suggest.
Correct. So Wentz needs to play better. Jahan Dotson, who just made a huge catch at training camp, so he's awesome.
Sweet.
I'm back on board on Jahan Dotson. I was too mean to him around draft time.
Okay.
So I think Dotson's going to be good. Him and McLaurin as a 1-2 punch. The defensive line staying healthy and rushing the passer like they did in 2020. That's the fun part about this stuff, right? Like, last year at this time, we're talking about how Washington made the playoffs, and maybe they're going to have a tougher run at it, but the defensive line is the best young D-line in the league, and they made these additions in the secondary. They added William Jackson, whose play fluctuates.
Yeah.
Last year was on the low end of variance. This year needs to be on the better end of variance. The pieces are there for Washington to make the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, Chase Young, rediscovering Chase Young.
Sure.
Would be a big thing. Yeah. You know, when you watch, he hasn't developed and become the kind of player that we thought he would be yet. Now, you look at his tape and the talent is still there. It's, remember when we were looking through Aiden Hutchinson's plays and you're like, you know what's a little bit concerning is that every win is the same? You know, they were all the same move. And you're like, okay, you're probably going to need more than that at the next level. And in particular, the way you're winning is not massively encouraging. Chase Young's tape in the NFL is kind of similar. Almost every win is an inside counter move. He's really good using his hands and shedding that block, and he's quick so he can get inside offensive linemen. And almost every single win he has is that inside counter. But at some point, I think offensive tackles are realizing he's not actually countering anything. You know what I mean? Like, there's no – the inside counter works because you're countering the overset that the tackle is making – because they're scared of the speed that you're showing them every single play. Young isn't doing that. So the counter has become the base, and there's no counter to the counter. So I think my point is that if he wants to become the player that it looked like he should become, and remember, he has college grading that places him essentially slightly ahead of Nick Bosa, Joey Bosa, those guys who have become Pro Bowl / All Pro type players. if he wants to be that guy, I think he needs to trust his freaky athleticism and speed and, like, attack the edge a little bit more. Then lean back on the inside counter that's devastating.
So we got the blueprint for Washington.
Just be better.
Wentz be better.
Everybody be better.
Defensive line be better. William Jackson be better.
Jamin Davis sort of getting there mentally in year two. You know, year one, you could kind of see the cogs turning, and it had him a step behind the play every single time. If he's there in terms of reading the play, then he can just take advantage of his athleticism and speed and all those kinds of things. That would be big.
And then from a run game perspective, is another one of those places where the run blocking was pretty good, graded well, but every time you look at their running backs, particularly Antonio Gibson, he was kind of like below average in expected yards or whatever you want to call it. So maybe my dynasty dude, Brian Robinson, the rookie, comes in and fixes some of that. So get better across the board here, Washington.
Okay.
All right, NFC North, Chicago Bears. Oh, did you fill in the AFC West?
Yeah.
Where do you want to put the West so it kind of makes sense? And do you want to put it with the other West toward the end?
I mean, I think once you've skipped the division, asking for it to make sense is folly.
It doesn't make any sense.
Just do it because we forget about it again.
AFC West.
Yeah.
From Matthew Miller.
The chat came
Denver
up.
Denver Broncos.
The chat room.
All right.
Gave us questions.
Matthew Miller, which offensive player takes the biggest jump with Russell Wilson?
Well, obviously,
Jerry
Judy,
Jerry of course. Yeah, I'm Jerry Judy. And I'll say Tim Patrick.
Yeah. I think you might, as much as I hate it, I think you might be right that it's Tim Patrick more than Jerry Judy. My concern with Judy is that I don't think the Broncos are going to give him the role to dominate the way he can. I think he can be a complete number one outside type of receiver, even with a relative lack of, like, mossing people type skills. But I think they're going to put him in the slot primarily and just let him be that guy where he gets wide the hell open every single play and he's your high-volume slot type of player. And that's fine. He'll be a really good player, and I think he'll take a big leap with Russell Wilson as his quarterback. But that's generally not the area that Russell Wilson targets the most. It's also sort of omitting an area of those big plays from his game that will place a cap on how good he can be. Whereas Tim Patrick will play outside a lot of the time, has shown the ability to go deep down the field, could easily become, you know, a high volume, deep target kind of guy in that offense, and may end up having a much bigger lead because of it.
I think everybody immediately thinks, well, look at what Russell Wilson did with Tyler Lockett. And I think you mentioned, you know, Judy doesn't have the mossing ability and just the straight up contested catch percentage. I mean, Tyler Lockett is at the high end of that. Think about all the highlight reel plays. We have Russ to Lockett in the end zone, back of the end zone, sideline, and the tight window catches that Tyler Lockett makes. I think Judy kind of does lack that in his game. Now, getting open and all that fun stuff, I think he'll do a good job of that. So, yeah, Judy takes a step forward. I think Tim Patrick, though, gets some more of those tight window opportunities, some of those throws that Russell Wilson excels with. So I'll go with that. I'll go with Tim Patrick. I mean, Cortland Sutton, too, man, 1 year removed from – you know, the injury, or, you know, another year of health, you know, from Sutton. So I would just lean toward the big-bodied receivers rather than Jerry Judy, we'll say.
Hmm. I think there's also – it's also possible that K.J. Hamler, as that designated deep threat, gets a lot of those moonball-type targets.
I hope so. I mean, do you think people look at Hamler as too much of a shifty slot rather than a speed?
No, I think he would play in the slot, but I think he would go vertical basically all the time. And Wilson will take those shots. He's just not going to, you know, work the intermediate level of the middle.
All right, Kansas City Chiefs. Adam Best is asking us to bet our life. Our life? If you had to bet your life on a receiver, which on a wide receiver leading the Chiefs in yards this season, is it Mecole Hardman, Sky Moore, Juju Smith-Schuster, or Marquez Valdez-Scantling? Which one and why?
Sky Moore.
You would bet your life on Sky Moore?
Of those four, yes.
Of those, well, those are the four. Those are the top four receivers on the Chiefs.
Yeah.
You're going to bet your life on Sky Moore leading the Chiefs in yards this season?
Yeah, I mean, assuming I have to bet my life on one of them, which I would imagine is the premise here, then wow. Yeah, he's the guy I'd put it on.
I disagree. Why?
Why? Because I think he has the best skill set of any of the four. I took a lot of crap because one of the Mike Sando things. One of the bits in that was from a guy saying that he believes that the Chiefs essentially are forcing Patrick Mahomes into this modified style of shallower targets, higher volume, higher efficiency, the stuff that Brady and Peyton Manning and blah, blah have pivoted to down the years. They're forcing him into that by trading away Tyreek Hill, essentially, and saying, well, you don't have the guy anymore to go YOLO deep down the field and throw this hero ball. You got to be more patient. You got to be more efficient, and we're going to remove the temptation of the guy that might be preventing you from doing that. I think there's some truth to that. I imagine there is a price at which they would have kept Tyreek Hill, but I think there's definitely an element to which they're saying, you know what, this might be good for Patrick Mahomes to make him play the style of offense that I don't want to say they struggled with last year, right? Because the Chiefs still like led the league in a bunch of categories offensively and put up a ton of points and yards and all those kinds of things. But when you set the baseline of otherworldly best offense in the NFL, Patrick Mahomes was unusually bad at staying patient and not making a mistake, which is what teams were forcing him into more and more. I do think there's truth to the idea, one, that Tyreek Hill didn't help that overall because of the sort of the pressure on Mahomes to take a shot. And number two, that there's people in the building in Kansas City that believe that and were happy to trade him away for all the picks because of it. So with that in mind, if that's the approach they're going, Sky Moore can work from every position along that offense, out wide, in the slot. He has an amazing package of release play, releases off the line of scrimmage. He can get open. He is tougher than people give him credit for. He's the best composite of the skills you need to get all the catches. Like, Marquez Valdes-Scantling is the deep threat. Juju is the limited slot guy that can be a possession receiver. Hardman is the gimmick. Sky Moore can do all of that at the same time.
Okay. Compelling case. Mm-hmm. Couple things here. First off, there's breaking news about the Chiefs.
Okay.
That I'll reveal in a second here. I was going to go Juju Smith-Schuster. I think a lot of what you said about them essentially extracting better rounded quarterback play out of Patrick Mahomes, fascinating case, and I don't hate it. But the breaking news, we'll come back to it. Let me say, it's Juju Smith-Schuster. He's been restricted in that Steelers offense. I think they'll expand his role. And Juju, he's pretty good at the catch point. He'll work a little bit from the slot, a little bit outside. I think Juju Smith-Schuster, in part because it is really tough. As much as I like Sky Moore too, man, it's so tough for rookies to be that guy right away. It is really difficult. I think we forget that sometimes because we've seen a few high-end rookies really hit the ground running. I'm not sure if Sky Moore's going to do that right away. So I'll take Juju. The breaking news is for the Chiefs. Free agent defensive end Carlos Dunlap. He's finished an X-ray. He, according to Josina Anderson, intends to sign a one-year deal with the Chiefs. She said Chiefs. I love it. It's the Chiefs, worth up to $8 million. I only find that funny because of the old commercial.
Please tell me somebody has quoted that with that picture.
I responded with great googly moogly. And I think not enough people get it. Only like, 7 likes so far.
Yeah.
But it's a good response. That's not disrespectful or anything, right? I mean, we're just having fun with a typo, which is cool. So Carlos Dunlap, the guy that is closest to my body type in the NFL, 6'8", about 280. He's my closest comp.
Yeah, very loose terms here.
Closest comp.
Just body type is adding some inferences there that I'm not sure you justify.
Height and weight, we'll just say height and weight. Just using those two data points.
I don't think the 280 is comprised the same way.
Well, of course we're referencing the 90s commercial where the guy paints the end zone and it's like, that's great, but who the Chiefs? And he says, great googly moogly.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, it's funny. It's much funnier when you explain it to everybody.
Anyway, Carlos Dunlap to the Chiefs.
Yeah.
So I'll take Juju, you'll take Sky Moore.
Sorry, why were you taking Juju? Did you tell us that?
Yeah. I think we're forgetting that he was really good as a complementary piece to Antonio Brown. He was good as a slot that ran vertically a lot more. He was in this Ben Roethlisberger dink and dunk offense where he was like his average depth of target. What do you average? 8-9 yards per catch each of the last couple of years, in part because of the offense, in part because Big Ben can't throw. So Juju is going to, they're going to tap into his skill set that has not been tapped into by the Steelers the last couple of years. So I think Smith-Schuster becomes more of a high volume guy. I think Sky Moore becomes a nice little third down option. I think Mecole Hardman becomes the, you know, he's the gimmick guy still, like you're saying, and Valdez-Scantling's the deep threat. But I would put Sky Moore third on that list, to be honest.
Third?
Yes.
You think he's going to have less yards than Marquez Valdez-Scantling?
Yeah, because Valdez-Scantling is going to have like 50 catches for, you know, 1,100 yards or something like that. That's what's going to happen. So I'll take Juju.
Okay.
Leading in yards. He's not an 8 yards per reception receiver.
Do you know what Valdez-Scantling's career high is for yards?
Like 550 or something?
690.
690.
He's got 2,153 yards in 4 years.
Yeah, he'll have 50 catches for 1,000.
More than...
Yeah, how many does Sky Moore have in the NFL?
I don't know, but he's going to have more than... He's going to beat Marquez Valdez-Scantling's average in year one, comfortably.
No, I don't think so. Las Vegas Raiders, we got the question is, Bo Sox lover 12, go Sox. It's been a rough. Did you see the Red Sox score? You even texted me the Red Sox score the other day.
Yeah.
28-5.
Is that what it finished?
Was the final. Yeah, there was okay. 28-3 at one point. Wasn't
it was.
It?
The 27-3. Yeah.
27-3.
Maybe you got the 28-3. They needed up. Brady. I didn't watch after that.
They needed Brady.
I saw the score, and with my very limited baseball knowledge, I was like, that seems like an unusually high number. I wonder what the record is for a baseball game. So I Googled it, and it was like 30-3 or something is the highest blowout. Big,
is that the Rangers?
I don't know.
Maybe.
But that's like the largest win margin ever. I was like, oh, look.
Terrible.
Boston's it was getting 10-0. I was the tune of a record.
I was driving to Maine. It was 10-0. I turned off the radio. I'm like, I don't want to listen to this game. And then I got to Maine and was getting text messages that it was 27-3 and all this stuff. It was.
Yeah.
Anyway, Bo Sox lover, also a Raiders fan apparently. Is the offensive line good enough for a top five offense?
Probably not.
It's a great test case, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
Look. Like Devontae Adams, Darren Waller, and whatever you think of Hunter Renfro. It's up there, man. Whatever I mean, that's top five, I think, as playmakers.
Yeah, it is. And it's another example of like how much moving one player can transform those kinds of things. Just like the Bengals with Ja'Marr Chase. Like, you're looking at that receiving group, and you're like, yeah, it's okay, but they're really in need of this, like, alpha. And then you get the alpha, and all of a sudden it's like, wow, this is one of the best receiving cores in the NFL.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you have Darren Waller, and he's one of those, you know, top five tight ends, the best, according to some. What an incredible starting point with Waller and Adams. So I think they could be a top five offense. I'll say yes.
So they ranked 17th last season in EPA per play on offense. What other things are worth looking at for that kind of just how good is an offense? Successful play rate. They ranked 17th again. Okay, so let's say they were 17th in offense last season. By,
I got to get up into the top five.
By at least two metrics. Does Devontae Adams move them from 17 to 5 at least?
Well, the Packers were top five, right? I think the Packers drop out of the top five.
But they also had a good offensive line. So that's they had Adams plus a good offensive line. Plus, by the way, a better.
No, I know. I'm just saying in this analysis, I think the Packers are going to drop off.
Yeah.
So who's going to jump up? I don't think the Dolphins get like, – of these teams that we're talking about, I don't think it's the Dolphins. I don't know if it's the Eagles. Like these teams that – the other teams that got the wide receiver one. I think the Raiders have the best shot of the teams who got this fresh wide receiver one because they have Derek Carr.
I mean, here's the thing. The other way of looking at it is if you look at the teams that did lead this category last year, Kansas City, one of the best offensive lines in the NFL. Green Bay, good offensive line despite weird personnel. Buffalo, creep back toward average, the first sort of average offensive line in the list. Tampa Bay, good offensive line. The Chargers, good offensive line, bar the right tackle. Dallas, good offensive line. Rams, good offensive line. San Francisco, good offensive line despite some questionable personnel. Patriots, good offensive line. Eight of the top 10 had at least good offensive lines. Buffalo being the one average one there. So... And the Raiders' offensive line was a lot worse than average.
Buffalo ranked about 20th last year, I think, O-line-wise.
Yeah, I guess below average, but overall it's an average offensive line, I would say.
And we're talking about the Raiders. You would need... Yeah, it doesn't look good.
They were like... Yeah,
on paper. Colton Miller's become a good left tackle. Beyond that, everybody else had below average war, below average grade. John Simpson, Andre James, Alex Leatherwood would have to take a massive step forward. Brandon Parker... Or you have a Dylan Parham step in as a rookie and play well. I don't know that the pieces are there with the Raiders.
Yeah, I'm
saying. Okay, so now you talked me out of it. I'll say no, they won't be a top five offense in EPA, but they will be top 10.
Okay, top 10.
AFC West.
Did you do the Chargers?
Los Angeles Chargers. Will the Chargers still invite the run, quote, invite the run with their new defense, or will they involve evolve that plan? That's from Catan Quincy.
I think they will still do that as part of the game plan. I think the way that Brandon Staley has been doing things, I think it's pretty clear that he understands the way the NFL is going in terms of where analytics and those kinds of things are pushing decision making from a coaching and schematic point of view. Now, he may have gone like beyond where it's pushing them in terms of some fourth down decisions and that kind of thing. But the idea that the Chargers are going to go for a lot more fourth downs than other people, they're going to go for 2 points more than other people, they're going to invite the run when that's, you know, sacrosanct and something you should never be doing. You stop the run first and foremost. He's going to be pushing the envelope for that kind of thing, at which point I think the fact that they got lit up last year doing that is not going to dissuade him from doing it. He just understands that that was a personnel problem. And we get in Khalil Mack, we get in Sebastian Joseph Day, we get in some other players, and we are going to be better against the run. We will still schematically line up in a way that says, yeah, if you want to beat us, give it a shot, and we'll hope that we're better than we were against the Cleveland Browns last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think, quick answer, yes, the strategy continues, and that they built, as you said, they built to execute it, right? I mean, it doesn't mean a lot of times, because we have different types of listeners, right, Sam? Like, we have people that know X's and O's, that don't, that listen to us in passing, listen to us religiously, whatever it might be. So sometimes we speak in some high level absolutes, right? Like, this team likes to play zone, play man, invite the run, stop the run. I mean, so it's more complicated than that, right? Defensive football is not just, hey, play six men in the box and invite the run. But there are these high level concepts, I think, that do get employed by certain teams, and that's one of them by the Chargers, and I believe they will continue with that. So sometimes it seems like we oversimplify things, but I think it's just better for the conversation. So just wanted to add that to the mix there. All right, let's go to the NFC North. Three more divisions to discuss here. Chicago Bears. Can coaching / scheme make the Bears offense better than projections? Offensive coordinator Luke Getsy comes over from Green Bay, Shanahan tree, etc.
Yeah, in case it wasn't clear, I edited some of these questions. Like, they, you know, they, that was the question. The question via email was more, you know, was structured in a way that has sentences and things.
Mr. C. Nile?
Yeah.
It's from Mr. C. Nile.
Mm-hmm.
Let me repose this. Are we not, because we throw Shanahan tree on every Shanahan tree. This Jets have the Shanahan tree, and the Dolphins have the Shanahan tree, and that means it's good. Are we missing it? The Bears, Shanahan tree. Are we missing some positive talk about the Bears because Luke Getsy is from the tree, the trust tree,
the tree
of the Shanahans?
And the Bears have been adding players to that offensive line the last few days. Riley Reiff, now probably their left tackle. They added a guard as well, who I forget who it was right now, but they have arguably the worst group of receivers and offensive line in the NFL on paper. Therefore, the projections of that offense have been bad. Can scheme offset that to the point
Michael
where it's
Schofield
actually a lot better? Michael Schofield. I mean, maybe a little bit, but I think it's still bad, right? Like, I don't think a Shanahan coaching tree can take what they have in terms of personnel and be like, so they may have a guy from the Shanahan coaching tree, but they didn't get actual Tin Cup, right? They didn't get the guy that can shoot 62 with a spade and a rake and whatever else Shanahan or whatever else Tin Cup broke out in that little montage to do the guy out of money. You know what I mean? Kyle Shanahan is capable of doing that. Everyone else has like the blueprint, but they don't have the skills.
They added your guy N'Keal Harry too.
Yeah.
Fellas Jones. I mean, what are expectations? Can they make the Bears offense better than projections? Yes. I mean, that's the answer for anybody. If the expectations are so low, I mean, we're talking about the Bears. Is anybody projecting the Bears to have better than a bottom five offense? Probably not.
So can they get out of the bottom five? Maybe.
Yes. I mean, look, it also depends on Justin Fields as well. Is if Justin Fields is as good, some people really believed in him, some people didn't believe in him. The people that really believed in him, if they are right, Justin Fields, arm talent, rushing ability, downfield throwing ability, all of the things that he brings to the table, if he's the one who takes that big step in year two, then he can drag Equanimeous St. Brown and Byron Pringle, and Darnell Mooney becomes a true number one, and N'Keal Harry becomes this yak monster that he can be, and the offensive line is, you know, whatever, 20th, 25th, then yeah, they could maybe not rank bottom five. But I think it's more Fields takes a huge step forward and you have some other guys emerge, and it just doesn't look great on paper right now.
Yeah.
So is it possible? Yes. I still rank them low.
Right. I mean, my overall point is I don't think that the scheme alone is going to be enough to offset what looks like a very, very bad group of personnel on paper.
Detroit Lions. Is there a case to be made that Jared Goff, could be good enough in Detroit and that he is some kind of long-term-ish answer? From Evan Donovan. Can Goff be some kind of long-term answer?
No.
Yeah. What's your long-term goal? I feel like we always start with the assumption every team wants to win a Super Bowl.
Yeah, which the longer we do this, the less I think that that's actually true.
If the question is, can we be the Vikings? Can we be a team that's going to win 8 to 10, 11 games, make the playoffs, compete for the playoffs every year, and we're happy having that quarterback? I would say yes, Jared Goff can be that guy, because that's what he was with the Rams.
So ironically, remember we were saying that Carson Wentz is a good example of a quarterback whose box score numbers don't really tell the story to whatever it was, 27 touchdowns to 7 interceptions, looks pretty good. And there's a group of Washington fans now. A couple of people use this word that I hadn't seen before, that everybody right now is like hepped up on hopium, right? Like opium, but with an H, hope. This period of hope right now. I hadn't heard that term before, but I like it. So the hopium is causing the Washington fans to look at Carson Wentz's box score and be like, yeah, he's a way better quarterback than you guys are saying. Like, what's wrong? Why are we saying this guy's not a good starting quarterback? Look at the touchdown to interception ratio. There's, I think, exactly the same thing is happening for a group of Detroit Lions fans who look at Jared Goff's box score last year and say 19 touchdowns, 8 interceptions, 91.5 passer rating, 67% of his passes complete. He's way better than you
guys
are saying.
Those were his stats last year?
He's way better.
I don't even look. Sometimes
saying.
I don't even look at traditional stats anymore. I look at the grade and what I know and other stats. I didn't even know those were his stats.
So there's a bunch
which
of people,
are very average, by the way, in today's NFL.
That's an element, right? Is it so the idea that everybody knows passer rating and it became this sort of stat that's embedded in everybody's brain? Well, the line has moved. Like 100 passer rating used to be the benchmark for insanely good play.
Right.
It's like 10 people last year had a passer rating above 100. It's not anymore. It's like, it's kind of expected. So for Goff to be 91.5, that's no longer amazing. That's like average. Anyway, and also, by the way, you look at some other numbers and you see immediately how much worse it is. Like 6.6 yards per attempt is significantly lower than anything he had in with the Rams, except that train wreck of a rookie season. Anyway, the point being, I think there's a chunk of people that look at that and have the same reaction and go, well, Goff's a way better quarterback than everybody's giving him credit for. Maybe you give him a couple of weapons, you know, and an offensive line that continues to get better, and actually he's a good quarterback. No. His overall grade was 60 last year. And again, okay, it'll get better if you give him some receivers and the offensive line continues to improve, but it won't get good enough, particularly when you consider the contract he's on.
Yeah, the concern with Goff is he's never really gotten better. And, you know, the thing that I keep saying is it's not Madden. No offense to Madden. Love Madden. Friends of the show. Players don't get better every single year. Jared Goff was terrible as a rookie. Better in year two, 75. That 75 grade in year two was Goff's second best grade of his career. His second best grade was year two. His best grade was year three. And he's dropped off each of the last 3 years. That's the concern with Goff. But I think he showed enough with the Rams that if you do put, you know, McVay's a good play caller and good weapons and good offensive line, you put that around him, can you win a bunch of games? Sure. So, like, if the Lions have a pristine team-building effort the same way the Rams do, and the goal is to be a playoff-caliber team, I think Goff has that in him. But that would have to be the goal, because the Rams already said, we don't think we can win a Super Bowl with Jared Goff. We're going to move on, and they won a Super Bowl once they lost Jared Goff. I think that kind of tells a story. If the goal is the Super Bowl, he's not your long-term answer.
It's also, you can't separate him from the contract that he's already on, right? If Jared Goff was on a rookie deal, And we were saying, hey, is he actually potentially better than people give him credit for? And could he be a medium-term solution? Sort of the way Jalen Hurts is, or even Tua. Like, these are guys that are on cheap money right now. So you can spend a couple of years to see how good they can be because it doesn't cost you anything. Goff, he's already on the big deal. You're willing to eat that because it was part of a trade to get first-round picks. But if he ends up being anything, you know, average or whatever, all you have to do is extend him and eat even more big money. And it's just not worth it. The calculus changes when the quarterback is on that big money deal already.
So we're both saying, depends on the answer. Depends on what you want, but
no.
Super Bowl, no. Playoff caliber team, he could be a guy. All right, Green Bay Packers. Is Green Bay's wide receiver group really worse than the Baltimore Ravens, Atlanta Falcons, and even Tennessee Titans? Seems like the hate has gotten out of control. Jacob Lewick? Lewick? It's like luck with an E in the middle of it.
It is. It's a lot like that.
It's similar.
Yeah.
Are we hating the Packers too much?
No. No, it's a bad receiver group. I think it's probably fair to say that hey, Baltimore's and Atlanta's is pretty bad as well. Tennessee's, I think, is a stretch given, okay, Treylon Burks is unproven, Robert Woods coming off an injury, but still, that's better than what Green Bay has. But the other element in there that I think was mentioned in this question that is massively relevant is Baltimore's Mark Andrews, who we said is their number one receiver, right?
True.
Elite pass-catching weapon. Atlanta has Kyle Pitts, who it was essentially their wide receiver one anyway. They have somebody in that group that means that the passing offense as a whole is less of a worry than Green Bay when you look at it and you say, who is Rodgers throwing to? Because their number one wide receiver is Robert Tonyan. Like, it's not the same thing, right? Robert Tonyan, who essentially is the guy that Rodgers was probably Rodgers created. So you got a bunch of guys, and none of them are high-end receivers. Like, their best receiver might be Aaron Jones, the running back. That's the problem in Green Bay. That's why everybody's focusing on them as opposed to Baltimore, as opposed to Atlanta, as opposed to Tennessee. Also because, specifically, Green Bay has Aaron Rodgers, back-to-back MVP, and wants to win a Super Bowl. And the question is, can you win a Super Bowl with a group that bad?
That's part of the issue, is the expectations for the Packers are high. They're a pass-first offense. We're talking about the Ravens. With the Ravens, you can at least say, well, they run the ball more than any other team, and they have Lamar Jackson as a runner, so therefore maybe it's okay to have a lesser receiving core. With Atlanta, they're straight-up rebuilding, and, you know, if Drake London's awesome, you know, that's a what-if, right? With the Titans, another where you say, hey, they run the ball a lot, and they like to run the offense through Derrick Henry, and maybe it's not ideal that they lost A.J. Brown, but they're a different type of offense. With Green Bay, it's like Super Bowl or bust. Aaron Rodgers is getting old, and that's why we talk about it more. You know, that's why we talk about, you know, how many Bucks receivers would be the top receiver for the Packers? Probably four. So that's part of the issue, I think, in Green Bay. Now, at the end of the year, if Alan Lazard, who Aaron Rodgers said was a Hall of Famer, if he has, you know, 95 catches and 1,500 yards, it's like, see, we had Alan Lazard, but then you're still unpacking, is it Lazard or is it just Aaron Rodgers needed to throw the ball to somebody and he was, you know, somewhat in the area. So the actual quality of the receivers, there are unknowns on all of those teams that you said. Who knows? Christian Watson could just be a star. Sammy Watkins could be rejuvenated. Who really knows? But on paper, yes, I think Green Bay's wide receiver core is worse or as bad as Baltimore, Atlanta, Tennessee. The hate is, I think, justified for the Packers. Minnesota Vikings. Does Kirk Cousins have a Matt Ryan 2016 season in him? That was Matt Ryan's peak year, his MVP season, a season that was unlike any other year for Matt Ryan statistically when he had Kyle Shanahan as head coach.
Yeah. Was peak,
play caller, sorry.
Peak Matt Ryan. This one is from Andy Z. No. I don't think he does.
No, in part because 2016 Matt Ryan was like insane. That was 9 yards per attempt. Just crazy town.
Yeah. It was insane. It was peak level Matt Ryan attached to a tin cup, making magic happen. Of course, we have another Shanahan tree system here with Kevin O'Connell. From McVay, from Shanahan, it's all connected. I just don't. So, a couple of points. One, Kirk Cousins is actually played pretty close to that kind of to his sort of peak for a while. It's just that it's still not good enough. Number two, I don't think we're going to see this insane level of just peerless play. I don't think Cousins has the kind of run where he's going to be amongst the best quarterbacks in the NFL for the entire season and not see a drop anywhere. I think what you're relying on, if you're buying into the idea that we could win with this in Minnesota from Kwesi and from Kevin O'Connell, is you're relying on what Matthew Stafford did last year in terms of playing kind of the same for most of the year, getting to the playoffs, and then catching fire for four games, which I think is really why Cousins was brought over in the first place. Remember, when they got
a better ceiling than Case Keenum and when they brought him over,
they'd had Sam Bradford, they'd had Case Keenum, they'd had a good team. They just went to the NFC Championship game in 2017. And the idea was, we bring in Kirk Cousins because he can do things that those guys and Teddy Bridgewater can't do. If we get in a bad situation and all of a sudden the game's getting out of control early on, Cousins can make plays those guys can't make and can go on a run and drag us back from the fire. The team then just disintegrated around him, so he's never got a chance to prove it. But I think that is that's the way that they can win with Cousins. Not by Kevin O'Connell suddenly turning him into the 2016 version of Matt Ryan, but by somehow they stumble their way to the playoffs and then hope that Cousins goes on a run of four games where he's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I would say no as far as the Matt Ryan season. I don't think Kirk Cousins will be MVP, if that's part of another way of posing the question. From Andy Z. Speaking of the Falcons and Matt Ryan, or at least the Falcons. Segue, Sam. Atlanta Falcons, here's a Falcons question. Smooth. As a Falcons fan, why should I even care about or watch this season? Seems like cruel and unusual punishment. From Daniel Simmons. That came through today. We needed a Falcons question. Daniel Simmons stepped up. Why should I watch the Falcons?
Because we like a lot of the players they added in the draft. And, all right, you're not going to win a lot this year, but these are all players of the future. Hopium, right? The hopium.
Yeah.
You get to look at all the players that are part of your future and be excited and get hepped up on the hopium.
I always sell that. I try to sell that a lot, you know, because we talk about all 32 teams. We try to give all 32 teams love, and I try to speak to the fans and say, look, we're looking for hope this year. You're looking for development from the prospects. You want to see Kyle Pitts. Can Kyle Pitts jump up into that Darren Waller, Mark Andrews, Travis Kelce group of tight ends? You want to see if Drake London, I mean, just watch because of how big all their receivers are. Is this strategy going to work of having a bunch of 6'4", 6'5", dudes? Like, Auden Tate is on this team, too.
This is also appears to be an NFC, or NFC South thing. Tampa Bay are loading up on 6'5" dudes left, right, center.
They're just taking anybody. Yeah, they just added Kyle Rudolph.
Like Julio Jones, Kyle Rudolph, Mike Evans. Like, they've got a bunch of giants as well.
So it's finding guys for the future. It's seeing, I think Marcus Mariota could be fun to just see if he's got a second wind in him, much like the guy that replaced him, Ryan Tannehill. Cordero Patterson is worth tuning in for.
There's a lot of exciting players on this team. Like Cordero Patterson, Drake London was one of the most fascinating prospects because of what he is. Kyle Pitts.
Brian Edwards in the fourth quarter.
Overtime TO, Brian Edwards. A.J. Terrell was an all-pro last season. They added Arnold Ebiketie, who was a really exciting pass rusher. They added Troy Anderson, who's just a phenomenal athlete at linebacker. Like, there's a ton of guys that are fun to watch this season and could potentially be significant parts of this team going forward. I look, if you're watching thinking, hey, have we got any shot of making the playoffs or winning a Super Bowl this year? No. But that's a lot of teams every year. There are still reasons to watch the team.
So that's it. I think for teams that are rebuilding and all that stuff, I always envision this world where fans are you know, into the rebuild, right? Or trying to have some hope. And you know it might not be the year, but you're going to tune in every week and watch the development of these players and have some new people to root for. And I think the Falcons are positioned for that. And, yeah, I think you're looking at 2023 as the season. If, you know, Brady's gone and other teams are in turmoil and you can make a move there, but that's why the Falcons should watch.
And also, by the way, like Desmond Ridder may end up starting games, and that could be your quarterback of the future.
Another good point. Carolina Panthers, does Matt Corral have any chance of starting now? Could he start at any point this season, from Ben Seifert?
I would say he would need to be like Dak Prescott to have any shot of starting early. So I would imagine the quarterback competition that would have been Darnold versus Corral has now become Baker versus Darnold, or Darnold versus Baker. And I would, just simply because of the volume of reps to go around, it's very unlikely that the third guy has the shot of unseating the two guys ahead of him. So even leaving aside the idea that Corral is coming from this RPO-heavy offense and the translation between that and an NFL system is massive, just the opportunity he's going to get to show that he should be even part of the competition is so small that he would need to be basically perfect every time he goes out there, and he would need to be immediately, obviously, way better than people thought he was, and that's probably not likely. So I think his chances of starting week one, you know, winning that competition, are basically zero. Whether he'll start at any point during the season is a much different question, because there's definitely a scenario where Baker wins the job, it doesn't go well, everybody gets fired, there's no point in throwing Sam Darnold out there, because what are you getting out of that? And you end up turning to Matt Corral to see if you have anything in the rookie late in the season.
It's probably just late in the season, right, if anything?
Yeah, or if the other guys, you know, injuries, or if they're just so stinking bad, you're like, they play their way to the bench, you know? It could happen.
I'm going to guess no, he's not going to start. No Matt Corral this year.
No Matt Corral.
Sorry.
Wow.
Baker, Darnold.
But also, Corral. I think people getting fired helps his case, because, like, you know, interim head coach comes in week 12, right? What does he have to lose throwing Matt Corral out there?
No, I disagree. I think teams, right or wrong, teams look at the interim coach and whatever he does as like a trial run. Like, hey, yo, did you get the team rallied? You know, did you win some games with this bad team? It's the weirdest thing to me. This like sometimes this 5 week stretch matters when you're hiring the next coach. When it doesn't really matter. Your stamp's not really on the team. You didn't put it together. You know, you just kind of get thrown into the mix. It doesn't really matter for the future. So I think interim coaches want to come in and win, not just be like, oh, I know what's best for the Carolina Panthers. Let's see what Matt Corral has. They're going to take whoever the best quarterback is and put him out there and hope that they go 5-0 and win.
But what if they're like, what if it's Ben McAdoo? Right?
Ben McAdoo wants another shot at it, man. He wants, look. I need a second shot. Watch out. Carolina went 4-1 under my watch down the stretch here when it didn't matter.
He was also the guy. Didn't he bench Eli? Wasn't that the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, he's all about seeing the next guy.
For Davis Mills? Davis. You know, the guy that used to play at Cal and Texas Tech and overthrew everybody.
Yeah. Why can't I think of his name now?
Man, my brain gets fried sometimes by this time. Damn thinking it. Back
what
here.
What is this? Davis Webb?
Davis Webb. I knew it was Davis.
Yeah.
Ah, Davis Webb.
There's only so many Davises out there. How hard could it be?
Davis Webb. And Davis Webb is one of those reasons why we didn't want to believe in Justin Herbert or Josh Allen.
Yeah.
I mean, he was not as athletic.
Just toolsy quarterbacks in general.
Similar big-armed quarterback who just was, you know, all over the place, accuracy-wise, all over the place. Anyway. Davis Webb. I say no Matt Corral. Let's go on. New Orleans Saints. Only the Kansas City Chiefs have more wins than the Saints over the last 5 years, and even last year they almost made the playoffs, the Saints. Why is everyone so low on them?
I haven't fact-checked any.
Barnett Warnock. What?
I haven't fact-checked any of these, by the way, so for all I know, that's a lie.
No, I mean, that's Barnett's stats.
Let's assume it's true.
Please, we're not being held responsible for here if you're fact-checking us. Also, the Chiefs and the Saints, when I was doing my draft study that I talked about a few weeks ago, I don't think you were on the show, highest war added for non-quarterbacks over the last few years. Saints and the Chiefs are the best drafting team that we've seen since 2014, also have the most wins. So why are we low on the Saints? Why is everyone so low on the Saints? Is that true? I mean, that's tough to fact check. Everyone is low on the Saints. Is that true? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think the reason they're being overlooked is because they lost Sean Payton in addition to losing Drew Brees, you know, a year ago. Like, they... The combination of Sean Payton and Drew Brees was why they were always winning games. Now, yes, it's true that even without Drew Brees, Sean Payton has a great record of winning games with quarterbacks that don't look like they should be winning games. Like Teddy Bridgewater had a great record stepping in, and then they did do a pretty good job with the unholy combination of Taysom Hill and Trevor Siemian starting at quarterback. But they don't have the guy anymore that was doing that. So now it's like, well, does that still hold with a completely new head coach who's not offensive minded, by the way, generally, you know, compared with Sean Payton? No, I don't think it does. So that's why people are down on the Saints relative to that kind of baseline, is because that's probably not a realistic baseline anymore. And the idea of like, hey, what does Jameis Winston look like in Sean Payton's offense? Can he become a completely different player? Can he make the big throws without causing the boneheaded decision that he always follows it with in Tampa Bay? And it looked last year like maybe that's possible in Sean Payton's offense. Well, Payton's offense isn't there anymore, right? The guy pulling those strings is not there. So everything you're expecting to happen from that point of view is probably not an option anymore.
Yeah, it's tough to evaluate Jameis last year, right? He only played up until week 8. He gets hurt in week 8. He had two game grades at 89 or better, and he had two game grades at 51 or worse. He threw a touchdown while falling backwards and was almost completely on his back when he threw it. He also threw an interception when he was falling backwards and almost completely laying on his back. This was in 7-plus games this happened. 6-plus games, really. So a lot of stuff happened in a short amount of time. You can look at EPA per play, and the pace was incredible for Winston. You can look at this touchdown-interception ratio and say it was 14-3. The year before, last time we saw him as a starter, he had 30 interceptions. Life was different. At the same time, his turnover-worthy player rate was not as good as maybe the interceptions would show. So there's not a ton to glean from Winston, except that there were some highs and some lows, and there was games when he hardly dropped back and games when he was good and whatever. So I think that's part of it, right? It's just the uncertainty around Jameis Winston as a starting point.
But I would still expect them to be the second best team in that division, to be chasing a wild card spot. Like, if that's your point, that, hey, you know, the Saints can be a playoff team, I think that's true. But
yeah, they'll beat the Bucs twice. You know, they'll have a good defensive line and a good secondary.
Yeah, particularly in the NFC, that's true. But are they a real contender this year with those things gone? I can't imagine that being true.
You lose Teron Armstead. You get a few more question marks, I think, on this team than you've had in recent years. But I think the Saints will be feisty. They'll be a feisty team.
Feisty.
This year. Barnett. Tampa Bay Bucs from Matt Martin. Can four wide receiver sets work with Chris Godwin, Russell Gage, Julio Jones, and Mike Evans? Will they work in Tampa's system? How would that look, or is it overkill? This came through today. Of course, Julio Jones signs with the Tampa Bay Bucs. Do you have any thoughts on this?
I have
thoughts, but...
Okay, well, give me your thoughts.
So first off, my question would be, how much of this is actually going to be Bruce Arians' system, right? He's gone.
Okay.
Did he have his fingerprints on it enough that... Now that he's gone and it's truly Byron Leftwich and Tom Brady working through this thing, is it really Arians' offense? Arians' offense relies more on tight ends. You're not going to run four wide receivers a ton.
Right.
You're running play action not a ton of play action, but it's more a lot of condensed formations and everything. But I think these moves are more strategic than tactical. Strategic in that we want depth at receiver for the season rather than we tactically want to have four wide receivers out there at all times. The other thing I'll pose, and this is why I bring up the Arians thing, he always had Gronk lined up in line, right? He was like, tight ends play tight end, right? And you didn't see a ton of Gronk out wide compared to New England. Do they get away from that a little bit? Do they actually put four wide receivers out there and have Russell Gage and Chris Godwin work in the middle of the field and kind of stealing some of those Gronk type of routes? So there's some questions as to the tactics here, but I also think that this move was more, we don't want to go into the playoffs where last year they lost Antonio Brown and Chris Godwin in two of the last 4 weeks of the season and then got into the playoffs and it was Mike Evans and nobody at receiver, Tyler Johnson and Cyril Grayson. They just don't want to have that happen again.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is nobody really plays four wide receiver sets. Like, the Cardinals are the obvious one with their air raid and the fact that they ran a ton of it when Kingsbury first arrived. Last season, the Cardinals led the NFL 13% in four wide receiver sets, right? They were the only team above 10%. The Bucs were at 1.8%, and that had gone down from the year before. So you're not going to see a bunch of those four guys on the field at the same time. They are there as a depth tool and as a rotation device, but they're not going to be featuring at the same time on the field. I love the Julio signing because I think if you have a good receiving core already, it is such a house money, free roll type of deal. Like, why the hell not? Maybe Julio Jones is washed and he's done and you're not going to get anything particularly useful out of him this year at all. On the other hand, maybe he's just been dealing with some injuries for a while, and if you get a healthy Julio Jones, particularly, you don't need to use him right away, right? You can play the long game.
You can ease him in. He doesn't have to be the number one.
So you can kind of get him healthy, get him eased into the situation. You don't have to lean on him late, but if they lose a guy late in the year like they did a year ago, imagine having like something approaching healthy Julio Jones to come in off the bench and be that guy. Or you have a scenario where teams have started to figure out, you know, one of the top couple of options and Julio Jones comes in and gives you something different. That's just such a boost to a team that expects to be contending and winning a Super Bowl.
Yeah, so I think obviously it's a good move. It's a worthwhile risk. You're not expecting, and Julio was the best wide receiver in the league for years. I mean, you're not expecting necessarily that guy. I also look at, you know, Mike Evans is really durable and all that stuff, but it's, you know, he gets banged up here and there. He misses a few plays in a game. It's just this depth piece that I think is really valuable. So they'll make it work. I don't think it's overkill. You can never have too many good wide receivers, in my opinion.
No, having them on the roster is not overkill. Potentially trying to get them on the field at the same time, sure.
Yeah, if the goal is to have them all have good stats, you're not going to achieve that, and that's okay. Four more teams. We get the NFC West to discuss here. Arizona Cardinals.
Yeah, so we have a question, which is a good question, about whether Vance Joseph deserves more credit than Cliff Kingsbury, and how does Arizona schematically outperform the talent on defense that we look at every year, and it's like, well, that's a bad defense. Short answer, they do a lot of simulated pressure. They're able to get pressure without having a ton of amazing players, and that covers up a multitude of sins. I don't want to spend any time on that, even though it was a good question from Hunter
Liljenquist. Liljenquist.
Thank you for butchering that. Because we haven't talked about Kyler Murray's contract stipulation.
Oh, okay. I was wondering why you were like,
yeah,
zipping
through
that.
We have to at least mention that. And so it came out, it was leaked, that the Cardinals put in a clause in the contract that Kyler Murray must do independent study of at least 4 hours a week on his own. Otherwise, he forfeits, you know, guaranteed money or whatever. Reaction, please.
It's just a perfect ending to the contract negotiations that were spurred by the guy that unfollowed the team on Instagram. It is a perfect ending to the contract negotiations. We had talked about, for off-field concerns with Kyler Murray, the idea that, oh, there was some excuse-making coming out of the playoffs. I mean, there is enough concern with those types of things that you hear, we got to have the 4 hours. You got to study 4 hours a week independently. And then how they track that, that's like a whole nother thing. Like, do we have to put something in Ultimate where we're, you know, tracking keystrokes and stuff like that, which, you know, we could do that if you need that, Cardinals. We'll make sure he's doing his work.
I mean, I would imagine they already have that stuff with the iPad, you know, where you can...
No, tell. I know. I'm just joking. It's a concern. Obviously, it was an issue for the first 3 years.
Yes.
But I want to take a step back, and I think it's an interesting data point, but sometimes when we're analyzing players and all that stuff, the individual data points don't matter. It's the outcomes. I would say if they were concerned about how he studied and all that stuff, what happened on the field? So on one hand, he was an 80-plus graded player each of the last 2 years. Right? Like, he was a good player each of the last 2 years, despite all of these concerns. And he got better all 3 years, and he's improved as a passer. And so there's this other evidence that no matter what the inputs were, we see what the output was. And it was good, and it was solid, and it was maybe something to build around. However, it's tough to ignore how alarming this is.
Yeah, but also the outputs weren't unimpeachable. So
true.
Because Kyler Murray has said things like this in the past, that like He's not one of these quarterbacks that locks himself away in the film room and spends 12 hours a day grinding tape and blah, blah, because he sees it. You know, I just see the game better than all these other guys. And if you were the best quarterback in the NFL, if you were Patrick Mahomes after his first three seasons of starting, and you said that, you couldn't argue, right? You would have to come to the conclusion that he is just one of these freaks that is naturally gifted in a way nobody else is, and can roll out of bed and just be the best guy out there, right? The usually high-end sports, almost nobody can do that because everybody's a freak, right? Everybody in the NFL is an absurd athlete, and therefore your advantage of being an absurd athlete no longer works because everybody is. This is a ridiculously niche sport for this to be. But the one player I can think of, or the one, I don't want to call him an athlete because a man walks around a table with a stick, but Ronnie O'Sullivan, the snooker, right? Ronnie O'Sullivan is a seven-time world
champion. Doesn't do enough film study, you say?
Literally doesn't practice as much as anybody else, right? Is like notorious for just being so freaking naturally gifted at this game, you know, gentleman's pool, essentially, that he can just roll out there, do half the work of anybody else, and still be better than everybody else. That doesn't work in the NFL. It just doesn't.
No.
And if you're out here saying, look, because Kyler Murray is a freak athlete, incredibly gifted, has a great arm. So do five other guys, right? Justin Herbert, Josh Allen, Aaron Rodgers, Jalen Hurts. Like, there's all these guys are freaks. So if they're freaks, the same kind of level you are, and they're in the film room grinding, you know, 4 hours a day instead of 4 hours a week, they're winning because they're doing things you're not doing. So for him to have that attitude is concerning because he hasn't had a Patrick Mahomes type start to his career. If he had, you couldn't say anything, right? You would still look at it and say, well, maybe you're leaving 10% on the bone and you could be even better, but I can't argue because you're the best quarterback in the NFL.
But we would still say, hey, the league can still adjust to you, Patrick. They can still throw different stuff at you, and if you do want to be the best ever, you're probably missing something.
But at least you could argue that, hey, it's working. He's the best quarterback in the NFL. Shut up, right? And if I was him, I would make that argument if I didn't want to do that work. But you can't argue that now, right? Where did he rank last season for us? Overall grade, Kyler Murray, like passing grade was third. Overall grade is seventh, which is fine. It's good. It's moving in the right direction. But it isn't number one by a distance. And if the guys ahead of you are all doing more work than you, you're missing out. And as you said, it wouldn't be in the contract if they weren't already concerned about it.
That's the part. That's the issue, right? So I don't think that there's a direct correlation to film room time and success, right? I mean, as much as we hear these stories, well, Peyton Manning and Tom Brady and Drew Brees and all these guys who know everything and study and whatever. That's one thing. We also read those stories about the guy we mentioned earlier, Davis Mills. Davis Mills not only had the cannon for an arm, the dude was a film junkie. He was going to study for 10 hours a day. There is a such thing for certain people as overkill, right? Like, you do have to have certain ability to react and all that stuff and play football. Like, all of that stuff, whatever. That's a more nuanced conversation. It does come down to the Cardinals felt like this was an important enough thing that we had to write into the contract. And then for some reason, Kyler Murray's agent felt like it was important enough to text it to Adam, to
I don't think
Ian
he
Rappaport.
Leaked it. I think he did the damage control afterwards where it was
did
like...
He? How did it get to Rappaport?
I don't know. That's the thing.
We know that Rappaport's usually getting
straight from the agent.
Who leaked this?
Because nobody looks good, right? Kyler Murray obviously doesn't look good because the...
Nobody looks good, of course not.
Right, that's what I'm saying. So who the hell leaked it? Because the summation is Kyler Murray doesn't do any film work.
It's Cliff Kingsbury.
And from the Cardinals' point of view, they just gave a ton of money to a guy that doesn't do any film work.
Cliff was like, look what I'm dealing with here. They just invested all this money in this guy that doesn't want to study. Don't blame me.
But the other point is, so it's obviously not... If you do film work, you become a great quarterback because of all those guys you said that are film junkies and stink. But the question needs to be asked, how many great quarterbacks don't do film work? Like, when was the last? Because even guys you think of that sort of play their instinct and they're
Brett
just...
Favre?
Yeah.
Is he the guy you're thinking of?
Because when you think of these guys that just kind of play by the seat of their pants and they're a gunslinger and they just go out there and ball, when you hear people talk about Brett Favre, like... When he went to the Vikings, all you were hearing was all these Vikings guys going, I didn't realize that this guy's in the film room like 24/7. And he's the first guy, you know, the classic cliche crap. He's the first guy in, the last guy out. the guy that you assumed wasn't doing that stuff was doing that stuff. You know what I mean? So if even people like Brett Favre are in there grinding more tape than anybody else in the building, and you have to have it written into the contract, 4 hours a week. How much film do you and I watch just to come in here and talk crap on a podcast?
True.
He's out there getting $160 million guaranteed over the next few years.
It's literally your job.
And they have to write it into the contract that he does 4 hours in a week.
That's the second part of it. 4 hours is a laughable...
It's nothing.
...number, right? The fact that it was like, come on, can you please just give us 4 hours?
If you can't give us 4 hours, we're going to have to take some money away.
Is he a known Call of Duty player? Because I saw the...
He's definitely a known gamer. I don't know if Call of Duty is his game of choice.
I did see... I don't want to not properly credit the tweet that was out there about Kyler Murray's production against the Call of Duty release.
Yes.
Right? Which is usually like right in the middle of the season.
Right.
And that is right when Kyler Murray drops off. So
hilarious.
Is he... I mean, you talk about Gen Z problems. It's Gen Z for
him. Yeah.
We're talking about Gen Z problems. We're talking, I'm going to unfollow you on Instagram. I'm going to play video games too much during the season. Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, at what point does he become a big enough name that he can single-handedly get them to move the release date of Call of Duty?
Oh, yeah. Like, can you guys just wait
post-Christmas?
Well, then the question is, does Kyler Murray not believe they're going to play in January? So where's Kyler Murray's confidence level? Hey guys, can you move the release to January 15th? It's like, oh, you think you're a first round exit type of team? You got to say February 15th, right? Right when the Super Bowl's over, then I'm ready.
And they'll move the Super Bowl again. You'll have to do it again.
Well, then you see how much Kyler fights for the March release.
That's true. Yeah.
Anyway, I think it's got to be concerning. The two massive contracts that were just given out. We've got a potential suspension looming for Deshaun Watson, and we have the Arizona Cardinals ensuring that Kyler Murray studies at least 4 hours a week outside of
which is also remember when we the team. When we reacted to the contract, the thing was like on field everything's going well. The concerns off field, or not even off field, but like the concern for Murray is the intangible stuff. It's the
intangibles
leadership.
Is better than off field description.
Yeah, it's
yes.
the leadership. It's the buy in. It's the the confidence that hey, things are going badly right now, but let's go, guys. We're going to come back. This is all tied up to that, right? If you're in there. Like, if you're one of the players in the Cardinals, like, can you imagine being a Cardinals player and that breaks, the news breaks? You must be like, are you kidding me? 4 hours a week is written into this dude's contract, and he's the guy that we're pinning all our hopes on to win us a Super Bowl. Like, I'm some third-string linebacker, and I'm doing, like, five times that. I'm just saying, that didn't go down well in the locker room.
Yeah, but that's just because you're not as good, and... That's just that's skill inequality.
But of all the things you don't want to hear about your quarterback that's just been handed $160 million guaranteed money,
oh,
that's
sure.
pretty
yeah,
high on
not,
the list.
Yeah, that's not helpful. Anyway, spent a lot of time on that.
Yeah.
Let's wrap it up, the last three teams here. Los Angeles Rams. The Rams led the NFL last year in non-QB war. That's wins above replacement. The three guys there were Jalen Ramsey, Cooper Kupp, and Aaron Donald. In particular, they carried that. How much regression should we expect, and can Stafford make up the difference? That's from Nathan Partolo.
I don't think you should expect much regression, because part of the reason they were one of the best teams, or the best team in that regard, is because it was all tied up in those superstars. Aaron Donald is still back, and given what we know of Aaron Donald's career so far, I think you could imagine him being amazing again. Jalen Ramsey is likely to be amazing again. If Cooper Kupp isn't as amazing as he was last year, I would imagine Allen Robinson makes up that difference. So I think they will be there or thereabouts again in terms of non-quarterback war.
Oh, yeah. Allen Robinson definitely helps. I would say non-quarterback war. In those particular players, we have to see some regression. Aaron Donald is special, but that was an extra special season. It was significantly higher than even just his three-year average previously. Jalen Ramsey, much higher than his previous 3 years. And Cooper Kupp, much higher than his previous couple years. So I think those particular players who carried the way will regress. I don't think Stafford himself makes up the difference, because he also had a career high in WAR at 3.91. So I think the superstars do regress. And then it comes down to, they're still a playoff caliber team. And much like last year, we're talking about a team that needed certain fourth quarter comebacks and zero blitz, incredible plays. Like any Super Bowl team, there's a handful of plays where things go either way. That's the Rams again, right? They're a Super Bowl caliber team. They'll need the plays to go that way, their way again. But I do think they will regress in non-quarterback war, even with Allen Robinson and Bobby Wagner coming in to maybe help out with some of the differences. They'll regress. They'll be a little bit worse than last year. And they'll be a Super Bowl caliber team again.
Anytime a team is worst or best at anything, the chances are the following year they won't be, simply because, you know, of regression to anything. But I would imagine they will be amongst the best teams in the NFL again in non-quarterback war.
All right, we did get a 49ers question during the podcast. CJ Leach, we needed one here. What do you guys think about the chances of this Niners D being a top five defense in the league, and how would that translate to the team's overall success this season? Essentially the Niners media, they're expecting a deep playoff run and that it's going to be more on the defensive shoulders than Trey Lance.
I would be pretty surprised if this was a top five defense in the NFL. I just don't know they have the personnel for that. They've got a couple of stars, they've got a couple of good players, but there's quite a lot of question marks that would seem to prohibit that from happening.
Yeah, they do always seem to maybe exceed our expectations or put together games. You know, they've done a good job, the Niners, the last couple of years of having, look, the playoff game that they won in Green Bay where they shut down Davante Adams and Aaron Rodgers, especially after a rough start to that game. That was impressive.
But remember, a big part of their success has been Robert Saleh, who's not there.
Yeah, I mean, D'Amico Ryans has done a good job there.
Sure. But last season, in terms, again, EPA per play, the thing that we use, 16th.
Right. I think it was interesting because, again, they would have games. Like, they did a pretty good job against the Cowboys and the Packers in their playoff wins. They had games like that. But, you know, they weren't great overall. It was not a great defense overall. It was a solid defense. They ended up right in the middle of the pack. They could be maybe a little bit better than that. I like adding Tre'Davious Ward on the back end there. But I agree, they're not probably going to be a top five defense. I think what protects them more, though, is even more running, potentially with Trey Lance. If you do get fewer possessions, you might see, you know, fewer points per game defensively allowed. CJ Leach, thank you for the question here during the podcast. Mm-hmm. We said no. Seattle Seahawks, last team here. Did Mina send in a question for the Seahawks? Nothing?
We didn't ask her.
I mean, she's one of our fans and listeners, and I assume that she would respond.
I think she's quite busy. You know, she does TV and stuff. She was out there throwing out a pitch. She has more pitches at a major league stadium than you do so far. I mean, obviously, you can change that.
I've got something in the works.
Yeah. But
my major league debut is coming up in a couple weeks.
That's pretty rough that Mina has a more extensive.
Well, I was invited to play at Fenway Park. I mentioned this. I was going to play at Fenway Park as a Division II All-Star.
Yep.
But we had to go play in the World Series.
Yeah.
During that game. My one chance to pitch off a major league mound thwarted by the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
Division II. But I'm going to have a chance at redemption maybe at Great American in a few weeks here. But yeah, Mina has more major league pitches than I do right now. Currently.
Tough scene.
Yes. And she didn't respond to our questions. So we had other Seattle fans. Drew Poulos. Poulos. Should Seattle fans want the team to be terrible this year or win 6-7 games? Which is better for a rebuild? I mean, be worse.
Really? You're always Mr. Like, you can't foster a losing environment. You got to keep muddling through and should convince everybody that you can still, you know.
Yeah,
win
but
games.
This means that's when you get a new coach.
When you
this would be Pete Carroll's last year, and you get a new regime in there, and you want a higher pick, and
so part of your
I want the pick of the quarterbacks next year.
So hang on, part of your sales pitch with the you want to stink is that will remove Pete Carroll from the equation.
A little bit.
Wow.
Not that I don't want Pete Carroll.
Sounds a lot like you don't want Pete Carroll.
No, I'm saying if you're going to have a new coach, the losing attitude from the year before matters less.
But if you win 6-7 games, they probably don't, right? So it is a referendum on whether you want Pete Carroll as the coach going forward.
I would root for the draft pick because I need a quarterback.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds a lot like you want to kick Pete Carroll the coach.
I change by the situation here if it's better to this is different. This is like, this is from a fan's point of view, right? Mm. So this is, I'm answering this from a fan, because this is a Seattle fan saying, what should they root for? Which is different from the head coach walks into the locker room and or is in a meeting with the GM and is like, we're going to tank this year. We're going to suck. We're going to teach the team how to lose. That is different, right? Instilling a tanking attitude to the team is different from a fan sitting at home rooting for the draft pick. The fan is not the team. So the fans should root for the best draft pick. Be bad. The team should try to win and not try to instill a losing attitude to the squad.
The way, though, that you institute, with the exception of that one random Eagles game in week 17 or whatever it was, you don't...
Which proved to not matter. Like, that didn't matter at all.
Except it helped them. It jumped them up and...
No, I'm sorry. It didn't matter that they purposely lost.
Right.
And that didn't project forward into more losing.
Yes. In fact, if anything, it helped them massively given the draft change that it gave them and what that spat out into. So my point is, you don't, with the exception of that one game, you don't go out there and say, we're going to lose this game. You achieve that by institutionally making decisions and make it much more likely for you to lose games.
So yes, I would do that. I'm behind that strategy.
So in Seattle's case this year, that is saying the quote-unquote winner of the Drew Lock, Geno Smith quarterback competition is our quarterback this year. And we're not going to go and bring in Jimmy Garoppolo, who gives us a better chance of winning games, because we don't have any interest in that this year. So that's the way they achieve losing more games, is by essentially not upgrading at the most important position in the NFL. I mean, honestly, splitting the difference is probably what you should root for, is not, you know, going on a losing, a winless season, not winning one or two games, winning four, and still having a really good draft pick, still being in a position good enough to get a quarterback, and not being such a miserable, like, train wreck that everybody is just giving up on what your chances are going forward.
Fair. If I'm trying to tank as a decision maker, I'm just going to make the decisions that are better for my team in 2023 rather than 22. I think that's how you approach that as a decision maker. Again, as a fan, I think that's fair. Root for four wins, a good draft pick. I would root for the draft pick, though, over, you know, winning a few games and playing spoiler against some of our rivals, that type of thing.
Yeah, I think his logic in that question was that, you know, if you're a 6-7 win team, it's easier to kind of convince people to come to Seattle, you know, free agents or whatever. I don't know how much of a difference that makes.
Yeah, there might be some element to that. I don't know. Same thing I said about the Falcons, though. I think Seahawks fans should be like, all right, who's going to be a part of this rebuild? Like, yeah. I'll be rooting for the two starting offensive linemen who are rookies and, you know, just trying to see the development of these young players and hoping for a draft pick so I can get my next quarterback, assuming it's not Drew Lock or Geno Smith. But who knows? Maybe those guys will surprise.
I think ultimately, if you're willing to pay free agent asking price, with the exception of being Jacksonville, people will go to where you are. Like, it's not, you know, nobody's looking at the difference between like two win team and a 7-game win team and saying, oh, I'm definitely not going there in free agency.
It's pretty gloomy up there, Seattle.
There's a lot of rain, but, you know, it's
pretty gloomy.
Because of that, it's very pretty and green and lush.
Yeah, sounds like someone from Ireland. All right. Well, that's it. We answered a question from every team, from every fan base. We appreciate it. Thanks for sending those questions in. We appreciate all of the interaction. And we thank everybody that's already starting to contribute to the next charity drive to see Sam, if he could throw 60 miles an hour with a baseball.
PFF underscore Sam. It's the pinned tweet there with the GoFundMe. Let's start firing in some money. In particular, all the people that doubted. All the people that were very, you know, vocal, saying there's no shot whatsoever me pitching 60, get in there and donate money so we can see.
Maybe that's how I'll donate, something like a dollar for every doubter, you know?
I think me and you just need to have a sum of money that the loser chucks into this.
But maybe that's what it is. We do a poll, again, I think we did it before, for every vote that says you can't do it, when you do it, you pay them, right? You give $1 for each vote,
okay,
for or against, something like that. I will figure it out. Not good doing that on the fly. No. Also, the survey, we do want to get everybody's feedback. This is feedback from the viewers and listeners so that we can make things better. At PFF NFL Pod. While you're there on Twitter, don't forget to hit that follow button. Follow at PFF NFL Pod. We're going to be doing a lot more from that Twitter account, announcements and polls and all sorts of fun stuff. So just trying to grow that at PFF NFL Pod, growing that on Twitter and TikTok at PFF NFL Podcast. And keep sending in those emails, nflpodcast@pff.com. Thanks to everybody for tuning in. We'll be back again on Monday. Happy training camp, everybody.